I'll speak to people at the sharp end of the problems, those who are supposed to be managing them, and those who have ideas about how to fix it. Housing Britain starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Monday morning at 11.
This is BBC Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 2nd of December. This is Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, the headlines today. NHS bosses have condemned as inflammatory a five-day strike called by resident doctors in England in the run-up to Christmas. We'll put that to the doctors' union. And the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, will lay out in Parliament today his plans to limit the right to jury trials in England and Wales. He'll be with us after 8 o'clock.
Also in today's programme, as Steve Witkoff prepares to meet Vladimir Putin, we take a deeper look at Donald Trump's property developer buddy, the man he trusts to end wars.
He certainly believes he can disarm people. And that's true of President Donald Trump, too. I mean, they both believe that through sort of force of personality and sheer charisma, they can get to a deal that others can't.
We examine the news that VAR might be used in the next World Cup to check corner kicks and yellow cards. What could possibly go wrong? And is appealing to kids the way to fill up empty cinemas? The boss of View unpicks the recent success of some family films. That's all after the BBC News read for us this morning by Tom Sanders.
The chief executive of NHS England, Sir Jim Mackey, has condemned the latest five-day strike planned by resident doctors as totally reckless behaviour at the most dangerous time of year for hospitals. The doctors' union, the BMA, says they'll walk out from December the 17th to the 22nd in their long-running dispute over pay and jobs. The health secretary, Wes Streeting, called it a cynical attempt to wreck Christmas. More from our health correspondent, Dominic Hughes.
What will be the 14th strike by the doctors' union since March 2023 has the potential to cause significant disruption, particularly in hospitals. It's been described as an inflammatory act by NHS bosses, given how the lead-up to Christmas is always a challenging time of year. But the BMA says it's been left with no choice because it's not received a credible offer from the government. A five-day strike last month followed a breakdown in talks between the union and ministers, and there's been little sign of progress since. The government had offered doctors a deal which involved creating more training posts, improving working conditions and helping them with expenses such as exam fees. But the BMA turned that down, saying any deal needed to involve an increase in pay.
The Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy will today set out plans to curtail the ancient right to a jury trial in England and Wales to try to clear a backlog of court cases and repair what he called a justice system on the brink of collapse. Last week, the BBC saw proposals which would end jury trials for all but the most serious cases. It's not clear if that plan has been approved by the Cabinet or if changes have been made. More details from our home and legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
There are almost 80,000 cases backlogged in Crown Courts, meaning many victims reporting crimes today won't see a suspect put on trial until 2029 or even 2030. Last week's leaked document said that David Lammy wanted Cabinet colleagues to approve a plan to end jury trials for defendants facing up to 5 years in jail that would cover Crown Court cases including theft, fraud and most violent sexual or drug offences. The document also proposed allowing volunteer magistrates to jail convicted criminals for up to 2 years, doubling their current powers. The government won't confirm the final plan ahead of the announcement, but has confirmed more than £500 million for victim services over the next 3 years.
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, will hold talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow today as the US pushes for Russia to agree to its amended plan for peace in Ukraine. Kyiv has welcomed the changes to the proposals, but Moscow is insisting on its demands for Ukrainian territory in the east. Last night, the Kremlin said the Russian troops had captured Pokrovsk, a key town in the region. From Moscow, here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
This will be Steve Witkoff's sixth visit to Russia this year. He'll be accompanied by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Their trip comes at a time of intense diplomatic activity. 2 weeks ago, the Americans presented to Kyiv a 28-point peace plan, widely seen as heavily weighted in Moscow's favour. One of its provisions would oblige Ukraine to cede parts of the Donbass it still controls. Since then, there have been US-Ukrainian talks in Geneva and in Florida. Now an amended plan will be put to the Kremlin. President Putin has said the original draft proposal could form the basis for future agreements, but he has shown little desire for compromise, believing that Russia is winning on the battlefield and can dictate the terms of any agreement.
President Zelensky has arrived on his first official visit to Ireland as he tries to rally support for Ukraine from Ukraine's European allies. After meeting President Macron in Paris yesterday, Mr. Zelensky warns that Russia must not be rewarded for invading his country. The Prime Minister has acknowledged that China poses real national security threats to the UK, but said not engaging with the country was a dereliction of duty. Speaking last night in the City of London, Sir Keir Starmer said that by taking tough steps on security, Britain could cooperate with China to deliver economic growth and security.
It's time for a serious approach, to reject the simplistic binary choice, neither Golden Age nor Ice Age, and recognise the plain fact that you can work and trade with a country while still protecting yourself.
In response, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Dame Priti Patel, said Sir Keir had become Beijing's useful idiot and his naive approach was putting Britain at risk. A committee of MPs says the government risks exacerbating a failing mental health system in England through inadequate investment. The Commons Health Select Committee says planned cuts to budgets for the next 3 years will undermine innovative programmes that have the potential to transform care. A health department spokesperson said it was investing in mental health services with £688 million this year alone. More from our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
Mental health accounts for more than 20% of the demand on the NHS, but it receives less than 9% of the health services budget. While funding has increased in real terms this year, 2025-26 will be the first year in almost a decade that the money available for psychiatric care has not increased in proportion to spending on physical health, with similar smaller rises planned for the next 3 years. The MPs have concerned 6 pilot projects, community hubs where people can receive individualised care without a referral, could be forced to close. The committee is calling on ministers to ensure people with mental health conditions are treated fairly.
A new treatment for bowel cancer that uses low-energy X-rays instead of invasive surgery has been approved for use in NHS hospitals across the UK. Doctors in Merseyside who pioneered the treatment say it should substantially improve the quality of life for patients and help reduce costs.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. We're going to bring you the weather a little bit later than normal, but let's turn first of all to the morning papers. Most of them focus on yesterday's resignation of the head of the Office for Budget Responsibility, or as the Daily Mail describes him, the fall guy for the Chancellor's budget lies. Sources tell the I paper that Richard Hughes could have survived the OBR's accidental leak, but his relationship with the Treasury had tanked after, according to the paper, he undermined Rachel Reeves' position on the state of the public finances. According to the Times, the pair were barely on speaking terms in the lead-up to his resignation, a period described by the FT as a moment of high tension.
Ministers are hoping, the Guardian says this morning, that Mr Hughes' departure will draw a line under what it calls the chaos surrounding the budget. But the paper says Miss Reeves remains under pressure. The Daily Telegraph describes her as battling to save her political career. One government insider tells the Mail that she is radioactive and contaminating everyone around her. The Prime Minister has lashed himself to the Chancellor's lies, one minister is quoted as saying. There's no way out of this for either of them.
As Sir Keir Starmer defended his Chancellor in a speech yesterday, the Daily Express claims he sparked fury by vowing to appease Brussels. It highlights the Prime Minister's comments that the UK should build a closer relationship with the EU, with the paper saying that he blamed Brexit for the disastrous economy under Labour. The Mirror quotes him as criticising wild promises which were made to people and not fulfilled.
Away from politics, The Sun this morning reports that a former England and Premier League footballer has been arrested on suspicion of rape. Sources describe to the paper how the man, who the paper doesn't name, was detained at passport control at Stansted Airport. Essex police say a man has been bailed while inquiries continue.
The Justice Secretary David Lammy sets out his case in The Telegraph for proposed changes to jury trials. He cites Magna Carta, writing that if its authors saw the delays in our courts today, they would not urge us to cling rigidly to tradition. but the Times reports that he's dropped the more radical part of his plan to scrap jury trials in all cases except murder, rape and manslaughter. And you're going to be talking to him, what, about 20 past eight?
We are, because there's clearly an issue with backlog, but there's also, as you were saying there, and as the paper was writing, a long-held tradition of the option in certain cases for jury trial in British law. So we'll put some of those thoughts to David Lammy, as you say, at about 20 past eight this morning. It is 9 minutes past six now. President Zelensky has said that territory is still the biggest issue to deal with when it comes to trying to negotiate a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, is due in Moscow later today for talks. James Waterhouse is our correspondent in Kyiv. Morning, James. He's going to be taking with him, presumably, this proposal, which has now also been worked on by Ukraine, which runs the risk of making it now less palatable to Russia.
Yes, I think the other worrying symptom, Anna, for the Americans and the Ukrainians is the news, so says the Kremlin, that they have now captured two more Ukrainian towns. So, yes, Steve Witkoff is going to arrive with Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law. They will present this plan. I do still think we are moving. There is, you know, very limited progress because of the both pace of the negotiations and perceived level of engagement. But you're right, you know, this is all on what Vladimir Putin will say or say at some stage after these talks. He's heading off to India for a two-day visit. You imagine the document may get pushed the other way, as we've seen little to no movement when it comes to Russia's red lines. But there is a backdrop this morning. You know, we're getting claims from the Russian side and slight denials from the Ukrainian side that the Russians are inside the city of Vovchansk, which is in the northeast of Ukraine, in the Kharkiv region, as well as now in complete control of Pokrovsk. They've even renamed it, the Russians, according to their propaganda videos, calling it Krasnoarmeysk, which means Red Army. It was what it was called until 2016. And again, you have the familiar sight of Russian soldiers moving in and planting a Russian flag in a desolate town square, one that we used to visit, you know, a couple of years ago. But it's taken that long for the Russian forces to eventually pull it in. So some worrying symptoms, but nevertheless, we're seeing this document move around at pace.
And just a very brief thought, James, as we said there, President Zelensky has identified it, and you were talking about it there, the movement of territory, the movement of the Ukrainian border is still a key issue in all of this.
It's the biggest one. And clearly, because of the difficulty for the Ukrainians, it's clear that the proposal of handing more land over has not gone away. That is not something he has been able to bat off. You've got the Europeans and Ukrainians saying, no, it's the current front lines. We start from there just to pause the fighting. But clearly the Russians, and you can't rule it out, the Americans have said, no, Ukraine is going to have to give up more land, notably the eastern Donbass region, in order for a sufficient compromise to be reached. It is not seen as a strong opener from the Ukrainian side.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv, thank you.
It is now 12 minutes past six. The death toll in the floods which struck Indonesia last week has now climbed to more than 500, with rescue workers still battling to reach affected areas. We can talk to Astudestra Ajeng Rastri from the BBC's Indonesian service. How many more people, Astudestra, are they looking for? How many people are now still missing?
Yeah, so the death toll, actually, you said more than 500. The latest data that we have from the National Disaster Agency is more than 600 people have been pronounced dead, and 400 more others are still unaccounted for. We're seeing 1 million people displaced and now looking for shelters. And we also get this really strong interview with one of the residents in central Tapanuli, which is the worst hit area, and it has been cut off for several days. Communication has been very difficult from that area. Internet has partially restored, and so yesterday we managed to call someone in central Tapanuli, and he said that it is completely paralyzed in that area, and it's very frightening because looting happened everywhere, and people are trying to secure food for their own. There have been incidents in food warehouses where people are fighting with each other over food.
This area is well used to having major storms. How does this compare with what we've seen in the past?
So last week's rainfall is actually very exceptional, and Indonesia was hit with a cyclone called Cyclone Senyar, which is also incredibly, incredibly rare for Indonesians. Being in the equator, we don't usually have cyclones. We do have rainfall and heavy rainfall, but never at this intense. So if you can imagine, the rainfall last week, in some places, it is double the normal amount that we receive, some even four times harder than the normal rainfall amount. So this has been surprising, but also, yeah, people were not ready to face these kind of intensity of the rain.
Hester Destra, Ajeng Rastri in Indonesia, thank you.
It is 6:15. If you've been waiting for the weather forecast, don't worry. Simon King is here. Morning, Simon.
Hello, Anna. Good morning. Yes, we've got some dry weather today compared to yesterday. We start off this morning, though, with a bit of rain affecting parts of East Anglia, the southeast of England. That's going to shift away to the southeast. And then for most of England and Wales, it's going to be dry. There'll be some sunny spells. But in Wales and southwest England, the cloud will increase. There'll be some showers moving in. Those become more numerous into the afternoon. And maximum temperatures across England and Wales getting to about 7 to 12 degrees. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, again, varying cloud. A bit of rain across the far northeast of Scotland. That's going to clear. Sunny spells for many, but showers coming into western Scotland. Those will turn heavier, perhaps even the odd thunderstorm into the afternoon, and top temperatures of 5 to 9 Celsius.
We're both poised for that then, weren't we? Thank you, Simon. Let us turn to business now, because, of course, that big news yesterday afternoon, the resignation of the head of the Office for Budget Responsibility. So how are investors reacting to that? Sean Farrington's here with more on that and the rest of the day's business news. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Anna. Yeah, the independence of the OBR, its monitoring of whether the Chancellor meets her own borrowing targets or not, by how much, that's all been one important aspect for investors to consider when making judgments on the strength of the UK. Of the UK economy. Now that the chair, Richard Hughes, has resigned, what next? Gervase Williams is chair of equities at the Investors Premier Miton Group. Gervase, morning to you.
Good morning.
What are investors going to be looking out for now?
Yes, it's interesting. This role, actually, at the Office of Budget Responsibility is quite a crucial role because it helps governments to keep safe in terms of international investors. We want international investors to continue to support the UK in terms of buying our debt and such like. And actually, he's done an extremely good job of just navigating the political cross-currency and the uncertainties regarding the UK economy. The UK has retained that support, and he's done a very good job. So I think he's going to be a difficult individual to replace in that regard.
Difficult to replace. Will investors be keeping a close eye on whether the person who replaces Richard Hughes is more in line with the government's approach to growth? There's been a few things, haven't there, where, you know, we've heard mentioned in the paper headlines, no doubt we'll discuss more over the course of the programme this morning, where the government hasn't been too happy that some of its, what it sees as policies for growth in the economy, haven't been reflected in the numbers by the Office for Budget Responsibility, and they're therefore impacting the future financial decisions the country can make.
Yes, I mean, clearly the government would like its view to be obviously kind of discussed more openly. But in a way, what they really want is actually to retain the support of international investors. And the danger is, if you get someone who's a bit too kind of pro your current policy in the government, is that actually you cross the red line inadvertently, and that leads to cost of borrowing going up, the cost of our mortgages going up, and all the uncertainties that come with that.
And Gervase, what do you make about what's come out of the report that's looked into this, that ended up with Richard Hughes's resignation? The fact that such market-sensitive data was so readily available to those looking for it. We know that investors right around the world use the height of technology. They think of every aspect. Are there some more questions to be answered here about who has been able to access this data and for how long into the past?
That's right. I mean, to some degree, if you get data which is sort of confidential prior to the rest of the market, then of course there's an opportunity for you to use your insight to actually make extra profits for your institution. So there is a danger there. I think in this case, although there was some disclosure ahead of time, I don't know if the market data got specific to individuals. Reuters were very early on to produce the data on a sort of open market basis, and everyone had it pretty much at the same time.
Elsewhere, Gervais, in financial markets, seen Bitcoin come close to a six-month low yesterday, sliding another 5%. What's around $87,000-ish now for a Bitcoin? What is that sort of telling you, and how do you see that reflected in other parts of the market when you see such big moves in crypto?
One of the key drivers of share prices around the world is interesting enough, the surplus, the trade surplus generated by China. The Chinese have this cash coming in from the products they sell, and then they reinvest it around the world. And that's been one of the key drivers of stock market buoyancy, really, not just this year, but over long-term periods. And what's been interesting is actually the Chinese economy is a bit slower. Some of the companies in China are not generating the cash they were previously. We have seen a setback in that. And I think that's one of the reasons why Bitcoin, which is a kind of good measure of global liquidity, has come back. Let's remind ourselves, even as recently as October, it was over $120,000 per Bitcoin. It's now, as you say, just under $87,000. It's down a third. And that just shows that market liquidity is just a little more uncertain, and that's affected share prices in the US and even in the UK.
Reminder of how quickly it can fall as quickly as it can rise as well, as we've talked about in recent times. Gervais Williams from Premier Miton Group, thank you very much. Good to talk to you, Gervais. Now, to the drugs industry, as the UK and the US have agreed to keep tariffs on UK pharmaceutical exports at zero when they arrive into the United States. That'll be for the next 3 years, all part of this agreement that will see the amount the NHS pays for medicine increase for the first time in more than 20 years. Richard Torbett is the chief executive of the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry. Richard, morning to you. What does this do for the pharmaceutical industry here?
Good morning, Sean. So the deal announced yesterday was a very important one for the pharmaceutical industry. We export 26 billion globally and more than 6.5 billion to the US. So getting zero tariffs was a very important step forward. More importantly, though, really important context is the investment by the NHS in innovative medicines has very substantially declined over the last 10 years. We used to spend about 14% of our health budget. It's now 9%, and that's led to two consequences. Firstly, it's been more difficult to get medicines to patients here. So medicines are available in Germany, for instance, that are not available in the UK. And second, we've seen the competitiveness for investment from the sector in the UK really eroded. So this deal is a very important first step to try and turn that round and build from here.
Do you think any of it will turn any of it around right now? Because in recent months, we've seen some pretty big decisions by pharmaceutical companies to invest a lot less in the UK, pull projects. Will any of this change their mind?
Well, I hope so. You're quite right. We've seen some big stories in the last few months, but actually they've been just the latest in a trend that's lasted around 10 years. We've lost a third of our global share in R&D over the last 10 years. We're still the largest private sector investor in R&D in this country, and we want to retain that. We want to grow it. So it's been very important that we use the deal announced yesterday as the start of a reset. There's a lot more we need to do, but we've made really good progress, and I think we can be optimistic, and we should be optimistic about the many good reasons to invest in the UK from here.
So what more needs to be done to say, when we've heard AstraZeneca pausing a £200 million investment in Cambridge, GlaxoSmithKline pledging to invest more than £20 billion over in the US in the next 5 years, what more needs to be done? What's the next move to get some of that money spent here in the UK?
Well, really, if you look at all of the factors that drive these decisions, the UK is in a very strong position on many of them. We've got great academic institutions, great research infrastructure, good intellectual property protection, and we've got a really rich ecosystem of biotech companies here. The thing that stood out like a sore thumb for many years has been the commercial operating environment. And so what's required is the start from yesterday's deal, but what we really need to see is the delivery of that sustained investment commitment that the government has now committed to. So I think as long as we see that real sustained increase in investment in innovative medicines get us back up to the sort of places that we see comparable countries, then I hope that the UK will be seen to be on a more even playing field with other countries who are also very keen to attract R&D investment.
Richard Torbit, Chief Executive of the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry, thank you very much. Hollywood blockbuster in the making now. Netflix has made a mostly cash offer for Warner Brothers Discovery, the entertainment giant behind everything from Harry Potter and HBO to TNT Sports and Tom and Jerry. Warner Brothers recently rejected an offer from Paramount, another giant in the world, valuing it at $60 billion. So we're talking big money here and potentially big changes for the way we see so much of what we watch being made. Lucinda Guthrie is head of merger market, financial data and mergers and acquisitions news provider. Lucinda, morning to you. What are Warner Brothers Discovery wanting here?
Good morning. Well, this is an incredibly exciting transaction. As you know, back in June, Warner Brothers had set out plans to separate out its streaming and studios and its global network, so its TV channels. What has subsequently happened, as you mentioned, Paramount's guidance has come in with a mostly cash offer. It looks like reports are saying they were thinking around $25 per share. And then at the same time, you've got Comcast and Netflix reportedly bidding just for the studios bit. They don't want the TV piece. What we've heard in the market is that Warner Brothers were more looking for something around $30 per share. But this is that's a huge increase to the undisturbed share price, which was what about trading around $13.
And in terms of the actual, like the industry here, why is it that Warner Brothers are looking to go through this and those companies are after those certain parts? What's changing about the entertainment industry?
Well, this is, in some ways, this is seen as the kind of end game for cable television, because the way that we are engaging with content is very, very different to how it used to be. You've got these mid-sized studios like Warner Brothers, and they can't compete with the likes of Netflix, for example, because it's just a very different model. Netflix has got this huge global subscriber base. It can pay for these enormous productions and spread the cost over a huge proportion of subscribers, whereas Warner Brothers Discovery doesn't have that huge base.
If it can't compete with the likes of Netflix, as you say, is this a good thing for viewers, customers around the world here in the UK, if it was Netflix that ended up buying a big chunk of Warner Brothers Discovery?
You're asking a question that a lot of people in Hollywood have raised concerns over, because obviously Warner Brothers has this theatrical aspect. The CEO, David Zaslav, he's said that he wants to make movies that people want to pay to go and see. So in some ways, the Paramount bid is seen as something that could, you know, potentially continue that trajectory. But it is a massive shift. And I think the antitrust piece, this isn't just about dollars per share. This is about the antitrust piece as well, because in Washington, regulators have said they would like to take a close look, and they've raised alarm bells about Netflix. And if you look at the Paramount side, the Ellison family have got very close links to the White House. Paramount has also put in place someone who people on the ground in DC are calling a Trump whisperer. McCann Delrahim was formerly in Trump 1.0. He was the head of the DOJ antitrust.
So there could be some political manoeuvrings behind this mega deal itself as well. Lucinda, we will wait and see as the offers keep coming. Lucinda Guthrie, head of merger market there.
Thank you very much, Sean. 27 minutes past six now. Carthy's here with the sport. Morning.
Morning. Thank you very much. We are just 2 days into December, but Premier League managers are already starting to look at the number of matches that lie ahead this month. Manchester City travel to Fulham today, with Pep Guardiola keeping an eye on their longer-term plans.
You see the schedule in my office, and I see December, January, especially January and February as well. So if we continue in the Carabao Cups and FA Cup is involved in this kind of stuff, so we have a lot of games.
13th place Newcastle United host Tottenham, who are in 12th place in the table, and Everton are away at Bournemouth. While England women are playing their last game of the year tonight, a friendly against Ghana. After retaining their European Championship title, it's been a successful year, but their manager Serena Wiegmann won't be drawn on whether she might renew her current contract, which keeps her with England until 2027.
I'm always like, 27 is coming. We have, I'm still really enjoying the job. I think the team is still enjoying that I'm around. I think that's really, really important too. And let's see what the future will bring.
Scotland women host China, and at 11 o'clock this morning, Wales women face Switzerland. England men have made one change for the second Ashes Test match against Australia in Brisbane. All-rounder Will Jacks comes in replacing the injured Mark Wood, the BBC's Stefan Schemmelt reports.
Jacks was a left-field inclusion in England's Ashes squad, but now gets the chance to add to his two Test caps and possibly cement a place in the team. Taking the place of the injured Mark Wood, Jacks lengthens England's batting at number 8 and gives a spin bowling option. Australia's Nathan Lyon has a better record bowling with a pink ball compared to the red. It's a blow to Shoaib Bashir, England's first-choice spinner for the past 18 months. If Jacks helps level this Ashes series with England's first win at the Gabba since 1986, he could carve a Moeen Ali-style niche as England's spin-bowling all-rounder.
And Jack Draper has delayed his comeback from an arm injury. The British tennis number one and world number 10 has pulled out of this week's Ultimate Tennis Showdown event in London. Draper has only played one singles match since Wimbledon.
Carthy, thank you very much indeed. Now, a word about some fascinating documentaries available on BBC Sounds.
When I looked at the past in my family, in that part of my family, what I saw was a great big gaping black hole.
Remarkable discoveries.
Dad was always very clear, it was nothing to do with me, nothing.
First-hand accounts.
I was effectively sentencing people to one of the most dangerous missions that they would ever embark upon.
And stories previously untold.
In 18 years, I've never given an interview about this.
Powerful documentaries from Radio 4.
This is The House at number 48.
The Magnificent O'Connors.
The Four.
The Second Man.
You're listening to Half-Life.
The History Podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
If you've not caught The House at number 48, I really recommend it. It's excellent.
Oh, is it good? I haven't yet. Yeah. Have a listen to that. It's 6:30 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. And Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
NHS bosses have condemned the latest five-day strike planned by resident doctors as reckless and inflammatory. The doctors' union, the BMA, plans to walk out between December the 17th and the 22nd in its long-running dispute over pay and jobs. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, called it a cynical attempt to wreck Christmas. The government will set out plans today to limit the right to a jury trial in England and Wales to try to tackle backlogs and delays in the criminal justice system. Last week, a leaked document said that the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, wanted to end jury trials for defendants facing up to 5 years in jail, meaning they would only continue for the most serious cases, such as rape and murder. It's not clear if the plan has been approved by the Cabinet or if changes have been made. Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff will hold talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow today in the latest negotiations to reach a ceasefire in Ukraine. Kyiv has welcomed recent amendments to American plans for peace, but Moscow is insisting on its demands for Ukrainian territory in the east. Last night, the Kremlin said that Russian troops had captured Pokrovsk, a key town in the region. The Prime Minister has said that it would be a dereliction of duty for the UK not to engage with China, but acknowledge the country posed national security threats. In a speech last night in the City of London, Sir Keir Starmer said that by taking tough steps, Britain could cooperate with China to deliver economic growth and security. In response, the Shadow Foreign Secretary Dame Priti Patel said Sir Keir had become Beijing's useful idiot and that his approach was putting Britain at risk. A new treatment for bowel cancer that uses low-energy X-rays instead of invasive surgery have been approved for use by the NHS. Doctors in Merseyside who pioneered the treatment say it could help thousands of patients avoid lifelong side effects.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's coming up now to 27 minutes to 7. An inflammatory act. That's how NHS bosses have reacted to the news. There's to be another five-day strike by resident, or what we used to call junior, hospital doctors in the run-up to Christmas. Hugh Pym is our health editor. They are not happy, Hugh.
Not at all, Nick, indeed, because this is just before Christmas and it's always very pressurised in the NHS throughout December and into the new year. This five-day walkout in England will be from the 17th of December at 7 a.m. through until the same time on the 22nd. And what NHS providers are saying, they represent trusts in England, is this is inflammatory, even more challenging than previous strikes in July and November, particularly so because a major task of hospitals just before Christmas is to try and discharge patients where at all possible, and the discharge process involves a lot of work for doctors, and that will be extremely difficult, they say. So Jim Mackey, the head of NHS England, is saying it's reckless, it'll cause maximum disruption, and it will, quotes, need a monumental effort for the NHS to keep going. Now, the BMA argument is that there is a real jobs problem for newly qualified doctors finding work, but essentially the dispute's over pay. They say they want a multi-year pay deal that hasn't so far been offered by the government, and they're saying this could be resolved with more talks, whereas Streeting, the Health Secretary, obviously sees it very differently, saying, well, they've had nearly 29% over 3 years, more than other public sector workers, and there just simply isn't money, but he is prepared to talk about other issues.
The BMA say it's about jobs as well as pay, don't they? That point about there being many, many more applicants for training places in the NHS than there are actually jobs to be filled. Does that look to you like a part of this that could be resolved?
Well, Wes Streeting did say that he was prepared to offer more training places, that is, training for specialist roles for newly qualified doctors. He initially said 1,000 extra places in England, and then said he would raise it to 2,000, but then a strike was called initially last month and now coming up later this month, and so the offer could well now be off the table. The BMA argument is there are junior doctors, younger doctors, who are being asked on their CVs for more experience than they've actually got to get these places, and some are facing unemployment. But to be clear, the ballot initially was about pay, and the government is saying that's what it's really all about, which is not being denied by the BMA. And in terms of pay, there isn't money. The BMA argument is, well, let's talk about a multi-year pay deal at least, and that doesn't seem to be forthcoming at the moment.
Hugh Pym, thank you. We're going to be hearing both from the BMA and indeed from bosses in the NHS later in the programme.
Just coming round to 24 minutes to seven, the government will set out proposals in Parliament later to try to reduce the unprecedented backlog in the courts in England and Wales. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry.
Morning.
This is an issue. Tell us more about the background.
Well, you know, it's a moment of constitutional seriousness, Anna, when people are arguing over different parts of Magna Carta just 810 years on. David Lammy's critics pointing to the clause, I think it's 39, which says that no one should be imprisoned except by the judgment of their peers, and that is seen as paving the way for trial by jury. The Justice Secretary, in an interview with The Times this morning, preferring another clause which says justice must not be delayed. That's the constitutional backdrop. The practical backdrop is that there are 80,000 cases waiting for trial in Crown Courts, and that means that many victims who would report a crime today would not see a suspect put on trial until 2029 or 2030. And that's essentially what this comes down to. The court's backlog is clearly one of the most severe public policy problems this government inherited. But the question that David Lammy will seek to answer today is whether restricting the right to jury trial is the right way to address it.
Yeah. So amid all of those different considerations, what is it that he is proposing?
Well, we still don't know precisely. What we do know is that one pretty radical set of proposals circulated to cabinet ministers would have abandoned jury trials in cases carrying possible sentences of up to 5 years in jail. That would have essentially ended jury trials other than for the most serious cases, such as murder. But there are some suggestions this morning that he has backed away from that, and that he will instead announce the scrapping of juries in a more limited set of cases. That would be the so-called either way cases, where defendants are currently given the choice of having their case heard by a magistrate or in a jury trial. Those are cases like assault, burglary, drug offences. Now, we do not know for sure. David Lammy will announce what he is precisely proposing in the House of Commons later today, and I think the political aftermath and sound and fury will be pretty significant.
Thank you, Henry. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. David Lammy will be on the programme at about 20 past eight. And it's worth saying as well that, in fact, we won't get that detail from him then.
either, because he has to announce it to Parliament first. So we will talk about the broader principles, but we probably won't have the answers either, even at that point.
It's one of those things that's frustrating for listeners and frustrating for MPs, but he's got an answer there. But he wants to get the argument out there, doesn't he, about why he's doing it at all. It's 22 minutes to seven. It's taken 13 years and cost more than £150 million to produce across two parallel investigations. But will the official report into the police response into the Hillsborough disaster offer the justice sought by the families of the 97 Liverpool fans who died during an FA Cup semi-final game in 1989. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz has been following this story for a very long time. What is it that, Judith, the families are hoping for or perhaps fearing?
Yeah, possibly the latter there, because this is a report. It seems astonishing, actually, to be saying this to you now, 13 years after it was first commissioned, when the police watchdog was then the IPCC. It's now the IOPC. And it set up an investigation in parallel with a separate investigation called Operation Resolve, all in the wake, you may remember, of the 2012 Hillsborough Independent Panel, which is what began to turn the tide of the narrative around Hillsborough. Set up the train of events, including the quashing of the first inquests and fresh inquests and criminal investigations, and also a police misconduct investigation. Now, that is what he's going to report finally today. And when I say, you asked me whether the families were hoping or fearing the outcome, I've been speaking to lots of them, and they say to me that, you know, that they are looking forward to reading the report, but ultimately they are very sharply aware that there isn't a single police officer who has been investigated who's still in service. All of them have either died or retired since 1989 when the disaster happened. And during that time as well, you know, they've been submitting complaints to the police watchdog. We already know through updates they've been providing that fewer than a third of those complaints are going to have been upheld. This is an exercise which, as you say, has cost north of £100 million. And so, you know, I spoke in particular to one relative last night, Hilda Hammond, whose 14-year-old son, Philip, was killed at Hillsborough. Now, her husband, Phil Hammond, was one of the leading campaigners for justice, but he died in January, still waiting for the IOPC report. And in July, Hilda finally received the results of the three complaints that Phil had submitted to the watchdog. Two of them have been upheld and the third was not.
It's bittersweet, really. Philip has died before he could get that, the final report. And I don't know whether I would have wanted him to see it, really, because it's like you were right all along, but we can't do anything about it. And that's what we've had all through this incredible journey. We've said from the beginning what was the truth. And it's too late now to do anything about it. So all the police officers cannot be disciplined, even if they were still alive or retired, because the law wasn't in situ at that time. So why go through all that? I just don't know what the purpose was or what the reason was to spend so much money.
Now, when investigators first started this process, they've told us they thought it would probably take a maximum of 5 years. Here we are at 13 years on. And we spoke to one former director of the investigation, Mike Bembo, who actually said, you know, that there are various reasons for that, including the overlapping different processes, including inquests, which have happened during that period. But he said one of the things which he is frustrated by is that even after all those years, here we are today, expecting the publication of what will actually be a summary report, 400 pages only. I say only because we understand that the full extent of the IOPC's research runs to many thousands of pages. That is not being provided today. We believe it will ultimately be given to the National Archives. But right now, as the families receive the report, it'll be lunchtime today, so 1 o'clock when this is released. That's the point at which we'll see how fulsome those 400 pages will be.
Judith Moritz, thank you.
It is 17 minutes to 7. Various stories in the papers this morning. The Financial Times has a very striking picture on its front page of a child being rescued from floods, being carried from a boat which is floating on yellow water in the middle of a street. This is in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo, yesterday. Nearly 1,000 people have died now because of severe weather across parts of Asia, Indonesia and Sri Lanka, among the worst hit by that heavy rainfall, which has led to flooding and landslides. The Daily Mirror this morning looks ahead to something which we're likely to hear more about later today. Justice for the Lost Victims is their headline. Police could bring corporate manslaughter charges in cases where post office staff took their own lives in the Horizon scandal. Again, something which I think we're going to hear more about from the police a bit later today.
And the OBR is all over the front pages of the newspaper, the Office for Budget Responsibility, of course, because its chief resigned yesterday afternoon. Now, some papers carry a pretty straight version of the news. OBR chief resigns after review blames budget leak on regulators' leadership. That's the Financial Times pointing out that the inquiry into how the whole contents of the budget were released early said that ultimate responsibility for the leak lay with, quotes, the leadership of the OBR. The Guardian has a similar headline. Other papers, though, do not see it in quite the same way. The I paper on its front page, OBR chief forced out after contradicting Chancellor over budget black hole. The paper reports that he was forced out, Richard Hughes, because initially his position was thought to be survivable, but tensions with the Chancellor made it impossible for him to survive. The Times has a long write-up about that. Serious gaffe was the final straw after fractious budget build-up, is its headline, saying that a senior government source described talking to Mr Hughes as like talking to a brick wall. That Rachel Reeves spoke about the recalculation of the productivity numbers as a challenge, but in private, according to the Times, used, quotes, far more colourful language. She was frustrated that the OBR would not score her growth measures that she thought would change the path of economic growth, and therefore they were happy to see him go once he made a mistake.
And on that point, a group of MPs had hoped to spend this morning cross-examining Richard Hughes, particularly about how the budget was accidentally leaked. But that won't be happening. That date has now been broken after he resigned. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
The Chief Secretary to the Treasury had come to the Commons to praise the Chancellor, not to bury the OBR. James Murray stressed how much the government valued the independence of the watchdog and its role at the heart of economic policymaking. Then, as he defended Rachel Reeves and updated MPs about last week's budget mega-leak, the Minister found himself announcing some breaking news.
I understand events are moving quickly, and I understand from messages passed to me there has been an event. The chair of the OBR has resigned, is what I understand from messages passed to me.
The head of the watchdog, Richard Hughes, quit after the OBR released by accident the main proposals from the budget, barely an hour before the Chancellor delivered her statement last Wednesday.
May I put on record, on behalf of the government, our thanks to Richard Hughes for his dedication to public service.
Just a little earlier, James Murray had told MPs that a report into the leak had described the incident as the worst failure in the OBR's 15-year history. He said this might not have been the first time sensitive information had been published by mistake. And he'd faced questions from angry Labour MPs like David Pinto-Duszynski, who said he'd been shocked by the OBR leak.
Given this appalling failure that the chair of the OBR himself acknowledges is the worst failure in the organisation's history, can the minister tell this House what he thinks it would take for the chair of the OBR to resign?
Well, the minister sidestepped that question, and a few minutes later, it emerged that Richard Hughes had in fact resigned. James Murray was in the Commons to deliver a two-for-one statement. As well as updating MPs about the leak, he was at the dispatch box to defend Rachel Reeves from accusations that she'd exaggerated the scale of the economic problems facing the country in the run-up to the budget. He said the Chancellor had been consistent and upfront with the public.
The Chancellor knew on November the 4th that challenging decisions would be required on tax and spend. The subsequent decision to freeze personal tax thresholds for a further 3 years shows that this was correct. Mr Speaker, the Chancellor took the step of delivering a speech before the budget precisely so that she could be upfront about the circumstances she was facing and the decisions that she would need to take. The Chancellor has been honest and consistent with the public in everything she has said.
But the Conservative Shadow Chancellor, Sir Mel Stride, complained that people in government had not behaved with transparency, openness and integrity.
It is a matter of profound regret that while the Chancellor chose to appear before the media yesterday, she did not see fit to appear here today. The Chancellor's credibility is in tatters. And to the long list of her failings in respect to these matters should be added that of disrespecting this House.
The Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, said the budget process had been a mess.
There has been leaks on a level that has never been seen before. Exactly. Huge amounts of flip-flopping that has created uncertainty for households, for the markets, and led to investment being put on hold by businesses.
And the leader of the SNP at Westminster, Stephen Flynn, said the Chancellor had not been entirely truthful.
Indeed, as one of my constituents said to me, travelling down from Aberdeen today, that she'd lied to the public. But while she was doing that, they're fearing for their jobs.
The DUP's Sammy Wilson thought the statement from the OBR was a lucky break for the government, which had allowed ministers to deflect criticism away from the Chancellor.
Who, weeks before, was using selective information, distorting the forecasts to cover up for the fact that she was taking money from those who work to pay those who don't work. And is that not the real shame of what we're discussing today?
James Murray said the Chancellor had focused on cutting the cost of living and NHS waiting lists. And he hoped Sammy Wilson valued the importance of the Office for Budget Responsibility as much as the government did.
Sean Curran reporting there on Yesterday in Parliament. Well, you heard there, MPs making that assertion about taking money from those who work for those who don't. And it is often said by critics of this budget that you would now be better off not working. The Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, quoted research this week, which states that a working family would now need to earn £71,000 just to match the income of a jobless three-child household. It's a pretty startling number. So how has that figure been reached? How real is it? Well, we asked the number crunchers at BBC Verify to take a look for us, and we're joined by their Ben Chu, policy and analysis correspondent for BBC Verify. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
It is always the case, Ben, isn't it, that these sorts of numbers are dependent on a series of assumptions you make about how to compare one group with another. So when you took a look, what did you find?
Well, it's a very striking comparison, isn't it? But this is a comparison which is from the Centre for Social Justice think tank. And what they did was they compared hypothetical families with more than three children and no adult in work with hypothetical families where one adult is in work full-time and another in work part-time. And this suggests that families with more than three children get more in benefits now after the lifting of the two-child benefit cap than working families. And it also suggests they get more than a family on the national living wage or on average wages, and that, as you said, the working family would have to bring in more than £71,000 a year to match the £46,000 a year in benefits of a three-child non-working family. But it's quite important to note that in this hypothetical non-working family, in these chosen examples by the Centre for Social Justice, also has disabilities and qualifies for incapacity support. And the family that's in work doesn't have kids. Now, the Centre for Social Justice says it's concerned about work incentives, and that is an entirely legitimate concern because the design of the welfare system can make work less worthwhile. But other welfare economists we spoke to at Verify argue that these kind of comparisons aren't actually the right way to measure those incentives, because the difference between these hypothetical households isn't just about whether they're working or not. It's obviously, as I've said, whether they're disabled or have children. If the working household were disabled or had kids, they would be liable to receive those welfare payments.
Yeah, because a lot of people who receive benefits are actually in work, Ben. So it seems to me that what you've found and what your team have found is this is a real example, but it is dependent on some narrow assumptions. And it could be that the figure is often quite a lot lower than 71,000 in other cases.
Yeah, that's another thing we found. The Centre for Social Justice confirmed to us that that 71,000 figure was based on the working family paying off student loans and also paying 5% of their income into a pension. If you remove those assumptions, the comparable figure is more like £61,000 to match the benefits. But I suppose the bigger point here, Nick, is that welfare economists stress to us that the way that the universal credit system actually works now is not usually possible for a given family where everything else is equal to be better off out of work than in work. And that's pretty important context to bear in mind when you see these claims made.
Indeed, the system was designed to ensure that wasn't the case, wasn't it? It was designed by a Conservative government, by Ian Duncan Smith, who is in fact the founder of the Centre for Social Justice.
That's absolutely right. Now, as I said, there are concerns about work incentives. That is a legitimate thing to be worried about. But bear in mind that the way the actual system works, and be a bit sceptical about these comparisons that you see.
Benji of BBC Verify. Thank you.
It is just coming round to 6 minutes to seven. It's expected that the government will announce plans later to curtail the right to a jury trial for various offences in England and Wales. At the moment, there are so-called either-way offences where the defendant can choose to have their case heard at the Crown Court rather than by magistrates. And the idea is by taking that away, it could help to cut what are huge backlogs in the court system. But will it be that effective? And also, is the judicial system damaged by removing one of its key pillars, which is the right to choose a trial by jury? Well, Chris Kinch KC, until last year, was the most senior judge at Woolwich Crown Court in South East London. Good morning.
Good morning, Alice.
Do you think those proposals will speed things up? Will they help to clear the backlog?
Well, Sir Brian Leveson, in his review, estimated, and it's a difficult thing to estimate, is that it might cut about 20% off the time that a trial takes. But even if you can do a bit better than that, you're still only making a four-day trial into a three-day trial. So that's not going to get through the existing backlog, and it's not going to do very much to reduce the flow of cases coming in.
Is the right to a trial by jury something that you think should be preserved?
Well, it's not just a right to trial. The prosecution can say they want the case in the Crown Court as well, and the magistrates have the power to send it there if they think that it should be there. But it is a right that has kept a link between the Crown Courts and the community that they serve, because ordinary people are brought in to make these very important decisions that have an effect on people's lives. So you would need a very good reason or find some better system if you wanted to replace it. That's my view on the principle, as well as the practical answer that it's not actually going to do very much.
Mm. You also managed the list at Woolwich, and I know you were doing what you could to try and get that down. What did you find was effective?
Well, what we did when we had a full complement of judges was we worked hard with the staff and the advocates to triage cases. It wasn't very popular because it created a great deal of extra work on the judges and on the staff and advocates. But we hauled cases in. We weeded out ones that weren't really going to be viable. And we made sure that we could list only those that were going to go ahead. And it worked. We knocked something like 200 cases off our backlog in just over 6 months. And we'd have gone on doing that, I hope. But we lost judges who were promoted or sent to other courts, and we couldn't sustain it for very long. And the list has since then has increased quite a lot. So there's no way of avoiding it. But some additional resources to blitz through the current backlog would, I'm pretty confident, have much more of an effect than these proposals.
And those, you know, extra resources would involve everything from, as you say, judges, prosecutors, people to defend the case, legal advisors, even space, you know, actual rooms to hold trials in.
Well, it would, and we've been struggling against those things for a long time. I mean, there are other things you can do. There are, ironically, that governments have been introducing and updating cases over the last 20, 30 years, like assaults on emergency workers that always used to be tried in the magistrates court. They're mostly assaults on police. And they're the ones that have clogged up our list at a time when they've been starving the Crown Courts of resources and making it so difficult for them to manage. So a little bit of smart work there would help also.
Yeah.
But Chris, there's no doubt resources are the answer.
Chris Kinch, KC, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to David Lammy after eight.
This winter, cricket's oldest rivalry is reignited.
Bowl him! Bowl him first ball!
England and Australia do battle to compete for the Ashes.
That is extraordinary!
Hear live ball-by-ball commentary on Five Sports Extra and get analysis and reaction of every day's play with the Test Match Special podcast.
The stump's out of the ground!
Test Match Special at the Ashes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Time for the weather. Here's Simon.
And thanks so much indeed. It's going to be a drier day than it was yesterday for many parts of the UK, but we do have some showers in the forecast. And for southwest England and Wales, we've got a few showers around this morning, actually. There will be some sunny spells, though, for a time through the morning before the cloud will tend to thicken. And with that, the showers become more numerous as we go through into the afternoon. And maximum temperatures get up to about 7 to 9 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, a bit of rain lingering on across parts of East Anglia, the southeast of England. That is going to move away to the southeast. There'll be some sunshine developing for many through this morning. Showers then will move in across parts of the South Midlands and southeast England later this afternoon, but temperatures get to 9 to 12 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, it's a mostly dry start to the day, but a few showers at first in northwest England. Those will tend to clear away, and we're going to look at lots of dry and mostly sunny weather into the afternoon, highs of 7 to 9 Celsius. For Northern Ireland today, variable cloud, chance of an odd shower or two, but for most it should probably stay dry with highs of 7 or 8 degrees. And across Scotland, still some rain affecting the far northeast of Scotland. That's going to clear away. Sunny spells then, mostly in eastern and southern areas of Scotland, but it's going to turn more showery in the west with that some risk of thunderstorms as well. Highs of 5 to 9 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 2nd of December. The headlines this morning. Russia's Vladimir Putin is meeting President Trump's special envoy in Moscow later after the White House said it was very hopeful of a deal to end the Ukraine war. NHS bosses have condemned as totally reckless a planned 5-day strike by resident doctors in England just before Christmas. We'll hear from the NHS after the news. And the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, will today set out detailed plans to limit jury trials in England and Wales to cut delays in the courts.
We'll hear from him. Also coming up in the next hour of the programme, it was a crime that broke the heart of many.
One of the kids in my lesson today was talking about cutting down the tree the other day. I think he was just him, and I was like, oh, right, it's a weird thing to joke about, isn't it? Yeah.
A new documentary tells the story about the people who investigated the felling of the Sycamore Gap tree. We'll hear from two detectives from the team who join us, and we'll examine the news that VAR might be used in the next World Cup to check corners and yellow cards. What could possibly go wrong with that? Before that, the BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, will hold talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow today after the White House said it was very optimistic about reaching a deal to end the Ukraine war. The Ukrainian government has welcomed recent changes to the US proposals, but Moscow is insisting on its demands for Ukrainian territory in the east. From Moscow, here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
This will be Steve Witkoff's sixth visit to Russia this year. He'll be accompanied by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Their trip comes at a time of intense diplomatic activity. 2 weeks ago, the Americans presented to Kyiv a 28-point peace plan, widely seen as heavily weighted in Moscow's favour. One of its provisions would oblige Ukraine to cede parts of the Donbass it still controls. Since then, there have been US-Ukrainian talks in Geneva and in Florida. Now an amended plan will be put to the Kremlin. President Putin has said the original draft proposal could form the basis for future agreements, but he has shown little desire for compromise, believing that Russia is winning on the battlefield and can dictate the terms of any agreement.
The talks in Moscow are taking place hours after Russian officials claim to have captured two frontline Ukrainian cities. Seizing Pokrovsk and Vostochansk would mark a step forward in President Putin's mission to control the whole of Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. But open-source intelligence projects that monitor the fighting suggests that Russia has yet to take full control of the cities. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Kyiv.
Russia's defense ministry has released a video of Vladimir Putin in military fatigues, apparently being briefed by his officers at a command post in the occupied Donetsk region of Ukraine. It is there where he's told about the captures of Vovchansk in the Kharkiv region and Pokrovsk in the east, where there is footage of Russian soldiers running through the mist towards the town's central square before they raise a Russian flag. A familiar optic from the grinding advances of invading troops. The Kremlin says it's also renaming Pokrovsk to Krasnoarmeysk, its old Soviet title, which means Red Army. Despite Ukrainian denials and the continued peace efforts, for Kyiv, the alleged capturing of these towns is a worrying symptom of Moscow's appetite to keep fighting rather than compromise.
President Zelensky has arrived on his first official visit to Ireland as he tries to rally support among Ukraine's European allies. After meeting President Macron in Paris yesterday, Mr. Zelensky warned that Russia must not be rewarded for invading his country. The chief executive of NHS England, Sir Jim Mackey, has condemned the latest five-day strike planned by resident doctors as totally reckless behaviour at the most dangerous time of year for hospitals. The doctors' union, the BMA, says they will walk out from December the 17th to the 22nd in their long-running dispute over pay and jobs. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, called it a cynical attempt to wreck Christmas. More from our health correspondent, Dominic Hughes.
What will be the 14th strike by the doctors' union since March 2023 has the potential to cause significant disruption, particularly in hospitals. It's been described as an inflammatory act by NHS bosses, given how the lead-up to Christmas is always a challenging time of year. But the BMA says it's been left with no choice because it's not received a credible offer from the government. A five-day strike last month followed a breakdown in talks between the union and ministers, and there's been little sign of progress since. The government had offered doctors a deal which involved creating more training posts, improving working conditions, and helping them with expenses such as exam fees. But the BMA turned that down, saying any deal needed to involve an increase in pay. The BMA's mandate for strikes expires in early January, but the union says it will be seeking to renew it through another ballot of its members.
The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, will today set out plans to curtail the ancient right to a jury trial in England and Wales to try to clear a backlog of court cases and repair what he called a justice system on the brink of collapse. Last week, the BBC saw proposals which would end jury trials for all but the most serious cases. It's not clear if that plan has been approved by the Cabinet or if the changes have been made. More details from our home and legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
There are almost 80,000 cases backlogged in Crown Courts, meaning many victims reporting crimes today won't see a suspect put on trial until 2029 or even 2030. Last week's leaked document said that David Lammy wanted Cabinet colleagues to approve a plan to end jury trials for defendants facing up to 5 years in jail that would cover Crown Court cases including theft, fraud and most violent sexual or drug offences. The document also proposed allowing volunteer magistrates to jail convicted criminals for up to 2 years, doubling their current powers. That package goes further than measures recommended to the government earlier this year by a senior retired judge. The government won't confirm the final plan ahead of the announcement, but has confirmed more than £500 million for victims' services over the next 3 years.
Hong Kong's leader John Lee has announced an independent inquiry into last week's fire that killed more than 150 people in high-rise blocks of flats. Accusations that the fire was spread by flammable construction materials have sparked widespread anger. 14 people have been arrested. The Prime Minister has acknowledged that China poses real national security threats to the UK, but said not engaging with the country was a dereliction of duty. Speaking last night in the City of London, Sir Keir Starmer said that it was possible to work and trade with a country while protecting yourself. In response, the Shadow Foreign Secretary Dame Priti Patel described Sir Keir as Beijing's useful idiot. The UK has criticised delays in aid being allowed into Gaza after more than 1,000 tents eventually arrived in the Palestinian territory. The Foreign Office said that other deliveries of UK-funded aid had also been unable to reach people in Gaza. The United Nations says 1.5 million people are in urgent need of shelter. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
Government sources said the 1,100 tents, which have now arrived in Gaza, had been prevented from entering the Strip for over a year. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, warned the situation in Gaza remained dire despite the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. And she added that the delay in getting aid into the Strip could not be allowed to continue, and that all crossings into the territory should be opened up to allow unhindered humanitarian access. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, added that the tents were welcome to provide urgently needed shelter, but that much more aid was required. The BBC has asked the Israeli government for a response.
A new treatment for bowel cancer that uses low-energy X-rays instead of invasive surgery has been approved for use by the NHS. Doctors in Merseyside, who pioneered the treatment, say it could help thousands of patients avoid lifelong side effects. Our health reporter Jim Reid has more details.
The treatment, known as Papillon, is currently being used in a handful of NHS hospitals, but can now be rolled out more widely across the UK. It uses low-dose X-rays to deliver radiotherapy internally through a tube inserted into the body. That means more patients with early-stage rectal cancer should be able to avoid surgery and the potential need for a stoma bag to be worn outside the body to collect waste. 14,000 new cases of the cancer are diagnosed each year. Doctors from the Clatterbridge Cancer Centre in Liverpool say the new treatment should substantially improve the quality of life for patients and help reduce costs to the NHS.
Jim Reid reporting.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past seven. Here we go again. There's to be another 5 days of strikes by resident, or what we used to call junior doctors, in the run-up to Christmas, just as the flu season is kicking in and patients are desperate to get home to their loved ones. The Doctors Union, the British Medical Association, are demanding not just a significant pay increase on top of those they've already had, they want a solution to the problem of there being far more qualified doctors than there are jobs for them to fill. We'll hear their case at 8:10. First, let's hear from the folk who run the NHS. Dr. Chris Strether is Regional Medical Director for the NHS in London. Morning to you.
Yeah, morning, Nick.
What do you fear will be the impact of these strikes?
Yeah, I'm pretty disheartened, really. The impact is always profound. We draw on the goodwill of other staff who have to fill in. It costs a lot of money to catch up afterwards and to pay them at the time. And it causes delay and disruption to treatment for patients, and that's harmful. And the offer from the offer to junior doctors or resident doctors that we sort out their long-term careers and postgraduate training and increased training places is a serious offer. But at the moment, I think asking for more money, considering they got a pretty reasonable pay rise over the last couple of years, considering the state of the public finances and the cost of living to other less well-paid people is just not reasonable. And so it's pretty depressing, really.
Just not reasonable is a fairly diplomatic way of putting it. The boss of the NHS in England, Sir Jim Mackey, has called it totally reckless. Do you think the BMA are now a union you can't really do business with?
Yeah, I think they're behaving, certainly totally irresponsible is a word I use. And it's harming patients. It's eroding the goodwill towards resident doctors that comes from other staff, from consultant staff, from nursing staff, and other clinical staff, but also from the public. And it's in the long term, it's not going to help the high regard with which the profession's held by the public. So it's highly irresponsible.
You will know, though, that there are junior doctors who are deeply depressed by where they find themselves, unable to get a job, having done all the training that they've done, forced to move hundreds of miles away from loved ones in order to actually get a work placement. If you set aside pay, there are real worries that are driving quite a lot of young people just to leave the country, aren't there?
Yeah, and we absolutely need to sort out the way we arrange postgraduate medical training for resident doctors, and it's urgent to sort some of that out. We've done a lot of short-term things to make things better in the moment, but there's the reform of postgraduate training is really important. But the sort of time the time and the managerial sort of effort to do that is being distracted, planning for a strike, which is coming just before Christmas and during the flu season when there are real pressures on the service. And we'd like people to get around the table and forget about the money, but talk about the stuff that's really about improving their working lives, which is and to be honest, Nick, that's urgent to sort that out. And we're frustrated that people won't come to the table and talk about it, and they're just adding the extra bit about more money, which is just not realistic at the moment.
Forget about the money is your message. We'll put that to the BMA a little bit later. Let's just end, if we could, on what you describe as the pre-Christmas pressures. What makes this period different from the strikes we've seen before? What will be the impact on people listening to them, if they're patients or if they care for someone who is?
Yeah, I think there are three things going on at the moment. One, we try and do as much planned work, diagnostic work and operations before Christmas to get people out of hospital before Christmas. And so that means it's a really busy time. The second thing is that, at the moment, there's a real peak in flu. The peak in influenza has come earlier than most years this year. And we had a day last week where London Ambulance had as many calls as they normally have on New Year's Eve, which is the busiest night of the year. So the pressures on the emergency services are greater when we're trying to do elective work and move people out of hospital. So we need all hands to the pump. And then the third thing is, you know, the other staff who have to fill the gaps get tired when there are lots of pressures and they're trying to work harder than usual anyway to get people clear before Christmas. So it's really bad timing, and we'd like the BMA to reflect on that.
Dr. Chris Strether, we'll see if they do when we talk to them in an hour's time. Thank you very much.
It is 14 minutes past seven. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, will hold talks in Moscow later, taking with him a revised deal to try to secure a ceasefire in the war between Russia and Ukraine. The Kremlin, remember, had made positive noises about the leaked first draft of that proposal, which was heavily weighted in its favour. The question is, now it's been refined by US and Ukrainian negotiators, will it still be something that Russia might agree to? There remains enough distance between each side's red lines that reaching a consensus will be a tricky ask, but that is something which Steve Witkoff, fresh from achieving a delicate ceasefire in Gaza, will be hoping he can persuade both sides to do. Steve Rosenberg is our Russia editor, and I asked him whether Moscow was likely to agree to a deal.
Well, the answer to that question depends on the contents, right, of the latest draft of the peace plan. In other words, exactly what proposal Steve Witkoff is bringing with him to Moscow. Because, yes, the original 28-point plan that the Americans handed over to the Ukrainians a couple of weeks ago was heavily weighted towards Russia. It read, to some extent, like a Moscow wish list. It was unacceptable for Ukraine. Since then, there has been intensive diplomacy. We had the US-Ukrainian talks in Geneva and then in Florida. President Macron met President Zelensky yesterday in Paris. The plan has changed. It's been amended. Those amendments have yet to be made public, but will be put to President Putin later today. Now, in Florida, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio had said that the aim of the talks was to leave Ukraine sovereign, independent and prosperous. And it's by no means certain that this is the kind of Ukraine that President Putin would accept.
No. I mean, is there any room for manoeuvre as far as the Kremlin is concerned? Where are its red lines that you don't think that President Putin will deviate from?
I mean, the big question is Vladimir Putin ready to make any kind of a deal? That's the question I was asking myself last night. I switched on Russian television, and there was Vladimir Putin in military fatigues visiting a command post talking to his military chiefs about Russian gains on the battlefield, being told by commanders that the Russian army had taken the Ukrainian towns of Pokrovsk and Vovchansk, and Putin claiming that Russian forces were advancing on practically all directions. He also condemned those in power in Ukraine as the thieving junta that seized power in Kiev. And all of this, you know, being shown just before Steve Witkoff arrives in Moscow for talks. What this shows, I think, is that if he is ready to make a deal, clearly, he expects it to be on Russia's terms. I think he'll only agree to a ceasefire, to stopping the war, if Ukraine is forced to make painful territorial concessions. And if a post-war Ukraine is susceptible to Russian influence, with no path to NATO membership, and with Ukraine's links to Western security structures severely restricted, and with international sanctions on Russia lifted, or at least some kind of roadmap to lifting those sanctions. But I opened one of the Russian papers, Moskovsky Komsomolets, and it said that the fog of diplomacy surrounding Steve Witkoff's visit to Moscow is a sign of an imminent diplomatic breakthrough, or at least movement towards one. So positive signals too, despite the sense that the Kremlin doesn't really want to compromise on the key issues.
Yeah, what is the broader US-Russia relationship like at the moment, Steve? Does either side have particular leverage over the other?
It's really interesting because, I mean, a few weeks ago, we saw what we thought were concrete signs of Donald Trump putting pressure on the Kremlin, on Vladimir Putin, right? Imposing sanctions on Russia's two largest oil companies that would have concrete consequences. And yet suddenly we saw, with this 28-point peace plan, a proposal heavily weighted in Moscow's favour that the Americans appeared to be pushing. So it's difficult to keep up with these changes from the Trump administration.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor in Moscow, thank you.
Let's turn it, coming up to 19 minutes past seven, to the business news. And Sean, banks are going to be allowed to have a smaller financial buffer, the buffer that's there to help keep the banking system stable.
Yeah, interesting development. We often talk about the Bank of England and its interest rate decision, but this is to do with its regulatory role overseeing banks, partly to avoid another financial crisis after the last disastrous one 17 years ago. It required banks to hold considerably more assets in reserve to protect against any major financial problems they might have individually or across the wider industry. This morning, the Bank of England is easing those restrictions. I've got William Peredin with me, who's Managing Director at Risk Control Limited Consultancy, previously advised the Bank of England on financial regulation. William, morning. Why are they doing this now?
I think they're doing it because of the perception that banks are quite constrained. They're not in a position to support the economy. It's not just in the UK that people are worried about that, in Europe as well. Obviously, there's a deregulatory activity in the US. There are sort of changes in leverage ratios, which is closely related to this topic the Bank of England's looking at. Mm. But I think it's all about growth. And regulators tend not to think very much about growth, but really broader policymakers need to have a good view of that. And
so is the logic what that they would lend more if they don't have such as big restrictions on the amount of capital they need to hold? I mean, they've seen pretty big profits lately. How confident can we be they will actually lend more rather than, say, continuing to reward shareholders with more dividends, for example?
I mean, few people have much sympathy for banks and bank profits. If we could wave a magic wand and reduce bank salaries, maybe we would. But banks are an unusual sector in that if you hammer the banks too much and make it difficult for them to lend, you hammer the economy. So there has to be some balance there. And I think what people are not quite focusing on is that actually in 2027, because of other regulatory changes, the kind of final implementation of Basel III, the capital constraints on banks will be going up. So in a sense, this is just a bit of a retreat from that general move of that's been going on for a while.
Is there
still going on?
Is there any risk here that we're making ourselves vulnerable to more risky borrowing again, very briefly?
Well, I mean, there is some risk, but bank capital overall is very substantially more than it was 10 or 15 years ago. So, you know, measures that people were looking at then were kind of 9 or 10%. Now they're sort of 18%. So banks are seriously well capitalised.
William, thank you. William Paradin there from Risk Control Limited.
Sean, thank you very much. It's 22 minutes past seven. The felling of the Sycamore Gap tree and the search for the perpetrators captured the attention of the nation, gave Northumbria Police a challenge the like of which they'd never experienced before. It is the subject of a new Channel 4 documentary. Here's a little clip of it with some of the 999 calls as they came in.
One of the kids in my lesson today was talking about cutting down the tree the other day. I think it was just him, and I was like, oh, right, it's a weird thing to joke about, isn't it? Yeah.
Northumbria Police, can I help? I've got a possible suspect who's got a motive, which I'll pass on here. I've got no evidence.
A local farmer believes they've got the name of a possible suspect.
It reminds me of my first job at the BBC, which was taking calls for Crime Watch. That, I imagine, it was quite frustrating at times for the police. Well, we can talk to two of those who are involved, Detective Chief Inspector Rebecca Fenny and Detective Inspector Callum Meikle, both, of course, of Northumbria Police, who are involved. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Will you forgive me if I briefly drop the titles and use your first names for this, just for ease of it? Rebecca, did you have any idea at all, Detective Chief Inspector Fenny, I'm changing my mind, I'll call you that, how big this would be as an investigation, how much attention it would get?
Absolutely not. I think it shocked not myself, but the rest of the team, Northumbria Police as well. We've never had such an influx of sort of media attention, community involvement. The significance and the high profile nature of this investigation is what lends itself to being, such a well followed, well renowned investigation, which has obviously very much put the spotlight of Northumbria Police up there in front of everyone and the investigation itself.
We heard a couple of those calls, Detective Inspector Meikle. Do you get a few people, as I say, I remember them well from Crime Watch, who say, I met a man in a pub who said he'd met someone who told him that he knew, etc., etc. Do you get a lot of time wasters?
I wouldn't say time wasters. I would suggest that they're people that are making phone calls with all good intention. But every one of those phone calls have to be followed up, and every name that's put forward has to be assessed. So it does add slightly to the workload.
Yeah, and it was a long investigation for you, was it not?
Yes, it was. We're now over 2 years down the line. So from the point of the investigation starting on the 28th of September to the point that they were actually found guilty, I think it was June of 25, and yes, it has taken a little bit of time.
And Detective Chief Inspector Fenny, I imagine it's one of those cases where some people feel incredibly emotionally about the loss of this tree, and there are one or two others going, well, what's the fuss about? It's just a tree.
Yeah, it's absolutely split opinion, I think, across the nation, probably worldwide as well. There are those that the tree has a lot of meaning. People scatter ashes there. People propose to partners there. It's quite a popular place for walkers because it is along Hadrian's Wall, which is a historical site. And it's part of a beautiful part of Northumberland as well. So it had a massive impact, certainly locally, but then nationally as well. I think the mindless damage of a tree for no reason whatsoever, I think really struck that sort of heart and strings of the nation. But equally, on the other side of the coin, you would get the comments of, well, it's just a tree and it's criminal damage. So I think it really just depended on a sort of the personal feeling you had around maybe the tree, but equally about the damage caused itself.
And Detective Inspector Meikle, you do rural crime. That's your specialism, as I understand it. Quite a small team, I would think, given the amount of national and international interest in it.
Yes, and I think that would be a surprise to quite a number of your listeners that the Northumbria Police didn't throw the kitchen sink proverbially at this. I literally was running a team with an additional detective constable, and then we had a very able analyst, and then I would run the day-to-day actions past the chief inspector to ratify any decisions that I was then making in relation to the investigation. So it was a very compact team, as you point out.
Now, at the end of the trial, and they were convicted, they are now serving their time, There was a discussion about why they did it. And I think that's the thing, Detective Chief Inspector Fenny, that intrigued people. What was this really about? What was your conclusion at the end of all this?
I mean, sadly, we don't actually know the motive behind the criminal damage by the two individuals. They never actually gave a reason as to why that was the case.
Let's talk about drunken stupidity by Carruthers, one of the
I think in my own opinion, I think it was for notoriety. I think it was to mark potentially a poignant date. I think what's probably shocked them is actually how meteoric this actually became and actually the attention that it garnered. And I think that was probably massively underestimated by the two individuals.
Yeah, well, if they wanted notoriety, they've certainly got it now, haven't they? Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Detective Chief Inspector Rebecca Fenny, Detective Inspector Callum Meikle of Northumbria Police. And the documentary on Channel 4 is called The Sycamore Gap Mystery.
It is 28 minutes past seven. Carthy's back with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. The Tottenham manager, Thomas Frank, says he is very confident he has the backing of the club's owners, despite Spurs only winning one Premier League game at home this season. Spurs are in 12th place in the table and they face 13th place Newcastle United tonight. Manchester City, who are 5 points off the league leaders Arsenal, are away at Fulham, and Bournemouth host Everton. The former Sheffield Wednesday owner, Defon Chansiri, has received a three-year ban from owning or being a director at any club in the English football league. Sheffield Wednesday have been given a further 6-point deduction by the EFL, leaving them 27 points from safety. Now, England women are playing their last game of the year tonight, a friendly against Ghana in what has been a successful year after the Lionesses retained their European Championship title. We can speak to the former England captain. Morning, Faye White.
Morning.
The England game tonight does look like a bit of a mismatch. England are ranked fourth in the world, Ghana outside the top 50. What is it that the Lionesses will want to get out of a game like tonight?
Yeah, I mean, you would suggest it nowadays with England so dominant and European champions, obviously, and also after demolishing China, who I think are around 16th ranked. They beat them 8-0 just the other day on Saturday. So, yeah, I think it's about Serena being able to just give them an experience like you would get in a World Cup about facing a very different, lower ranked team. But also, hopefully, she'll make some changes and give some of the younger players who are just maybe a debut or you know, just give them that experience of starting in a, you know, a big game for England.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because they're coming to the end of what has clearly been a strong season, retaining the European Championship, very important. And the England manager seems to have managed this changing of the guard quite well. Players like Mary Earps, Fran Kirby, Millie Bright retiring from international football. But the younger players, as you mentioned, some of whom did play in the summer at the European Championships, it shows quite a strength in depth, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, so those younger players often in a major tournament come in as, you know, an impact player or a sub, but you never know when someone might be injured, or like we had even this time with Hannah Hampton suddenly being thrown into it because Mary Earps retired, which was, you know, obviously a shock at that time, given her age and the fact that keepers can go on so much longer. But you never know, like with Leah Williamson's been out for a long time with injury. So you need the likes of Esme Morgan, Maya, Letizia getting opportunities. Lotta Wubemoy, who actually one I hope does get a start today, because, you know, give her an opportunity. She's been around a squad for a long time. So I think she needs to be, you know, being put in that position of starting and feeling those nerves at the pre-match and getting used to that as well. But yes, I think you've got a very young team now with a lot of the big names kind of not there, a lot of the names that everyone got to know during the Euros.
Yeah, an exciting night ahead, and hopefully the next couple of years while we still have Serena Wiegmann as the England manager. Faye White, thank you very much for joining us to mention a couple of other matches tonight. Scotland women host China. And at 11 o'clock this morning, actually, Wales women face Switzerland. And the England men's cricket team has made one change for the second Ashes Test match against Australia in Brisbane. All-rounder Will Jacks comes in replacing the injured Mark Wood, and it's a day-night Test match, which starts on Thursday.
Thank you, Carthy. Time now to hear about this year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal.
Imagine facing Christmas without the warmth and safety of a home.
Having nothing to protect me from the elements.
I'm scared sometime.
Thanks to your generosity in last year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal, people facing homelessness found the support they needed and the chance to turn their wish for a safe home into reality.
It feels like, yeah, I can finally live life again properly.
It changed my life. Yeah, it do change my life.
The Radio 4 Christmas Appeal, making a difference. on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday morning at 9:45.
The weather today should be breezy, some variable cloud around and some showers as well, but it should be a bit drier and brighter to the east.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at 28 minutes to 8. Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff will hold talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow today as the US tries to convince Russia to agree to an amended plan to end the war in Ukraine. Kiev has welcomed changes to the proposals, but Moscow is insisting on its demands for Ukrainian territory in the east. The talks in Moscow are taking place hours after Russian officials claim to have captured the key city of Pokrovsk. But open-source intelligence projects that monitor the front lines of the war suggest that Russia has yet to take full control of the area. NHS bosses have condemned the latest five-day strike planned by resident doctors as totally reckless. The doctors' union, the BMA, says its members will walk out from the 17th of December as part of a long-running dispute about pay and jobs. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, called it a cynical attempt to wreck Christmas. The government is to set out detailed plans today to limit jury trials in England and Wales. A leaked document last week suggested the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, wanted them to be reserved for only the most serious cases, such as rape and murder. But it's not clear whether that plan has been approved by the Cabinet. The aim is to reduce court backlogs. The UK has criticised delays in aid being allowed into Gaza after more than 1,000 tents eventually arrived in the Palestinian territory. Government sources said the tents, which will provide shelter for thousands of people, have been prevented from entering Gaza for a year. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said all crossings into the territory should be opened to allow unhindered humanitarian access. The BBC has asked the Israeli government for a response. The NHS has approved a new treatment for bowel cancer that uses low-energy X-rays. Doctors in Merseyside, who pioneered the treatment, say it could help thousands of patients avoid invasive surgery.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is now 26 minutes to 8. Wanted, a new boss for the OBR. The Office for Budget Responsibility was created, remember, to stop the perception that politicians could play fast and loose with economic forecasts to make them say, or at least appear to say, well, what they wanted them to say. And the last few days have shown the power of that office, not just to demand of the Chancellor evidence for claims that her policies would transform the performance of the economy, but also to challenge the political narrative too about why she took the decisions she did. Now, Richard Hughes was due to give evidence to a Treasury Select Committee today. It could have been quite a moment, but yesterday afternoon he quit his job, ostensibly because of that very embarrassing leak. The leak, in other words, of the entire budget contents, I'm sorry, because the OBR had accidentally put up a link to its analysis of that content with a very guessable address. Plenty of people think that's not really the reason he went, though. What was the problem was the relationship between him and Rachel Rees. Well, we'll discuss that in just a moment with Sir Charlie Bean, who knows about these things, formerly the Bank of England, formerly a member of the Budget Responsibility Committee of the OBR. But first, on the details of the leak itself, we want to get the thoughts of the man who was involved investigating it, Kieran Martin, former head of the National Cybersecurity Centre, who led that investigation.
What I think is behind what happened is, at its root, a decision more than 10 years ago for the OBR to maintain an entirely separate web presence, and that was to demonstrate total independence from government. It seems to me like that was a false choice. I don't think anyone will particularly care what the exact domain address is of the OBR's website. And the consequences of that decision is that a body that was charged with the secure publishing of major documents of national significance had the capabilities of a small or medium-sized business instead of the capabilities of a major government department.
Well, listening to that, as I say, Sir Charlie Bean, who was former Deputy Governor for Monetary Policy at the Bank of England and a member of that key committee that runs the OBR up until 2021. Good morning to you, Sir Charlie.
Morning, Nick.
Let's begin with that. Let's begin with what went wrong, if we could, that we were just hearing described by Kieran Martin. The responsibility, the ultimate responsibility for that leak lay, said the review, with the leadership of the OBR. Given that report, do you think it was inevitable that Richard Hughes paid with his job?
Well, I think it made it quite difficult for him not to offer his resignation. I should say, I think Richard was a very effective leader of the OBR, energetic, rigorous, fair, sometimes perhaps a little undiplomatic in his public communications. But given that this was a really serious failure to make accessible the contents of the budget ahead of the Chancellor's speech, and given the contents of the report that was released yesterday, which Professor Martin just summarised, I think it was difficult for him not to offer his resignation.
I'm noting your words very carefully, which is he had to offer his resignation. In other words, the Chancellor could easily, if she'd had a decent relationship with him, say, well, thank you very much for offering to fall on your sword. You're doing such a good job, I'd like you to stay. She evidently didn't do that, did she?
No, and I should say it's not just the Chancellor. I mean, the OBR plays a role in shedding a light on the public finances. And as much as anything, that helps MPs in general to hold the executive to account.
No, forgive me. I was asking you, though, whose decision was it?
The meeting of the Treasury Committee. So both the Chancellor and the Chair of the Treasury Committee he submitted his resignation to, and I think either of those could have indicated that they wished him to stay. Clearly, the Chancellor is important, very important in this.
But as far as you know, I'm sorry I interrupted, I was trying to get to the bottom of who didn't accept the offer. Are you saying you think the Chairman of the Treasury Committee was also happy for the Chairman of the OBR to go?
All we can see is the absence of either of them stepping in sufficiently quickly. Now, I don't know what went on behind the scenes, where there was any consideration to them asking Richard to stay or not. I think we would be in a better position today if he was staying, but the fact is that he's going. But I don't know the details that went on yesterday afternoon.
But you're clear that the Chancellor, for one, made his position impossible in the end.
Well, the Chancellor clearly accepted the resignation, yes. That's pretty transparent.
So let's go on to why this matters. Because what surprises people is that the OBR is a pretty small outfit with just a few dozen staff, isn't it? Who are basically number crunchers. But they are sometimes described by politicians as if they're the most powerful people in the known universe. Now, the reason they complain, politicians on left and right, is they believe that the OBR, people like you in your old job, are kind of guardians of the conventional wisdom. So that if you come up with something that's a bit radical, if you're a right-winger and you think, cut taxes to create dynamism in the economy, if you're on the left and you think what we need to do is massively invest in infrastructure to increase the capacity, what they say is the OBR will never score it on its forecast, and that means you don't get the credit with the financial markets, and it makes innovative policy making very difficult. Fair or not?
Not entirely. The key thing I think about the OBR is it's a mechanism to try and keep politicians honest, to prevent wishful thinking. Now, it's not true to say that they won't score the sort of measures that you've suggested, but in doing so, what they will do is draw on existing evidence to calibrate the likely size of those effects. So if you take something like increased public investment spending, it's not just simply a case of increasing public investment, but it has to be sustained for many years to make a substantial interest to the public sector capital stock. So it's not surprising that any effect over the 5-year horizon of a forecast is very small.
But isn't this a problem for the country, Charlie? Because if economists agree, and many of them do agree, that the Chancellor is right to increase public investment, to try and get a better trade relationship with the EU, to reform the planning system, but the horizon of the number crunches is 5 years rather than 20, the danger is nobody ever does anything. Because politician has to get elected within 5 years. Those numbers affect their futures in a way, frankly, they don't for some guy sitting in Whitehall putting numbers into a computer.
I think you're right here. There is a fundamental problem, but it lies less with the OBR. It's the fact that these policies which benefit the supply side of the economy take a long time to have an effect. So any government that introduces it, whether you've got an OBR or not, you're unlikely to see the return within the lifetime of that parliament. I do think there is a role, though, for the OBR for spelling out the longer-term consequences if policies were followed through. And, for instance, we did this when I was on the OBR. You'll remember that during Boris Johnson's time as Prime Minister, when Rishi Sunak was Chancellor, there was a big uplift in public investment just before the outbreak of the pandemic. That wouldn't have a material effect on supply within the 5 years of the forecast, but we did note, and there were in the text, that if sustained, it would add so many percentage points to potential output. And that was something the Chancellor referred to in his speech.
Yeah, so that's useful advice to the next occupant of that rather tricky job. So Charlie Bean, formerly of the OBR, formerly of the Bank of England, thank you for joining us.
17 minutes to 8. VAR might be used more widely in next year's World Cup, with an expanded role to also include interventions on corner decisions and on second yellow cards as well. It's being discussed at the moment. It's being considered as well for future inclusion in the Premier League. Well, Janie Frampton is a former FA referee and FIFA instructor. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think? Because obviously VAR has not been without controversy, and the argument is that World Cup matches are important and these decisions are important, but I suppose fans would argue they are in any game. Do you think it's a good idea?
It's a real tricky question. So to start with, we know that at corners can often lead to goals. So in the course of the World Cup, that's really important, but it's, like you say, important in any game. So to get them right is equally as important, but we need to be really careful. We are sanitising the game. The stoppages in the game already are very, very difficult. So do we really want to bring in more? And corners are not as clear as people think they are. There's lots of pushing, shoving, shirt pulling at corners, let alone the ball going out for a throw-in or a goal kick or corner kick. So there's an awful lot to actually take into consideration there. And if you go to a VAR review, then it could take a while.
Yeah. The second yellow card one is interesting as well, because I was thinking about this. If you're going to review the decision on the second yellow card and therefore obviously a sending off, surely you would have to review the first yellow card as well retrospectively to make that make sense.
Yeah, good question. I think that would be chaos. Mm. So can you just imagine the situation that maybe there's an advantage played on a yellow card and somebody goes and scores. Then the referee comes back, gives a second yellow maybe, which they shouldn't technically, but they do. And then they send them off. Or do they wait on the pitch waiting for review, or do they go to the changing rooms? And then if they win the review, they have to come back out the changing rooms. Complete chaos, as well as your really good point that absolutely they would have to review the first one as well.
It sort of raises all kinds of questions, doesn't it? The fact that the technology exists and the fact that it's already being used, you can see why they would want to expand it and do more with it. But then it means like conversations like this just continue, and it does add to the overall complexity of the game.
Yeah, you know, I want people to go into work on a Monday morning after a weekend of football, and I want them to talk about how well their team played or didn't. I don't want them to constantly be talking about the VAR decisions. Let's remember, VAR was brought in originally for clear and obvious mistakes or decisions the referee had missed. Now, we've already moved far too far from that. Although I do believe in the long run, assistant referees will be replaced by AI in some form. So I think we have to embrace technology, but we need to be careful what we wish for.
Yeah. AI assistant referees, that's a whole new conversation, isn't it? Jamie Frampton, thank you. Can you imagine how much time we'd spend talking about that around the water
cooler? No controversy there, I'm sure, would there be? It is now 13 minutes to 8 and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker with us in the studio this morning is Dr. Krish Kandia, theologian and founder of the Sanctuary Foundation Refugee Charity. Good morning to you.
Good morning. The Oxford English Dictionary's word of the year is rage bait. Online content deliberately engineered to push our emotional buttons, to make us click, share and seethe. While I had begun to think my growing frustrations were simply an unfortunate side effect of ageing, now I'm wondering if it has more to do with rage baiting, or even, as some suggest, rage farming. Rage has become such a valuable commodity that there's a whole industry working on the cultivation of indignation. It seems to be working. I'm noticing it is not only me who feels angrier. The world around me appears to be getting angrier too. I experienced it last week, travelling to work. The man next to me was outraged about a story that he'd just read on social media. The story was unfounded, but he didn't seem to notice. He was angry with a whole group of people who in actual fact had done nothing wrong. Soon he was angrily blaming them for all the ills in society. Anger and public transport don't mix well. I sat there wondering how I should respond and whether it would make any difference. 70 years ago this week, Rosa Parks found herself on public transport in Montgomery, Alabama. She'd just finished her work for the day as a seamstress. She needed to get home because in the evenings she volunteered as an evidence gatherer, recording the stories of black women who had been abused by white men. It was dangerous work, but as a committed Christian, she trusted God to keep her safe. Then, on December 1st, 1955, she sat on the fifth row of the bus and refused to move when the driver told her to make room for white passengers. She was not the first to resist bus segregation, but her arrest and the bus boycott that followed sparked a nationwide civil rights movement. That led to the toppling of Jim Crow laws that enforce racial discrimination in public spaces, workplaces and schools, and most importantly, established the principle that African Americans were entitled to full dignity, equal citizenship and federal protection of their rights. It laid the foundation for every major civil rights victory that followed. The brilliance of the civil rights movement was its commitment to respond to the rage around them with non-violent resistance. The Apostle Paul gave a similar call to all Christians. Do not be overcome by evil, he wrote, but overcome evil with good. When I find myself getting angry, whether it's social media or in real life, and when I see others around me getting angry, I cling to that verse and to the example of Rosa Parks. I try to resist the rage. May God give us all the strength to resist indignation with steel-willed compassion.
That was Thought for the Day with Dr. Krish Kandia. It is now 10 minutes to 8.
The UK and the US have agreed a deal to keep tariffs on UK pharmaceutical shipments to America at zero. It means that the NHS will pay more for drugs. The government says it will protect British exports and preserve jobs. But Leila Moran is a Liberal Democrat MP and chair of the Health Select Committee. She told us the £3 billion bill for the NHS was concerning.
Who is going to pay for this deal? So while I understand that we're going to be tariff-free for 3 years, it's essentially committing in the much longer term the NHS bill for drugs to go up by £3 billion. And at the moment, we have no clarity on whether or not that's going to come out of NHS coffers eventually. The reason the UK spends less on drugs is because of the bargaining power of this incredible thing that we've got that almost, well, no one else has, which is the jewel in the crown of our country, the NHS. And so we shouldn't be saying to ourselves, well, you know, we've got a really good deal and therefore we should be buying more of these drugs. We've got a really good deal because we've set up this incredible system that everyone's rightfully very proud of. From the UK point of view, it does feel a bit like the government seems to have prioritised growth in the economy over the longer term health of the NHS.
That's Leila Moran. Well, Professor Sir John Bell joins us, was Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford University and has advised the government over the years on life sciences. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think the first thing to say is this is it's complex. It's a difficult thing, I think, for people to understand. And even if you look at the papers this morning, the Times front page calls it a boost for patients. The Guardian, though, highlights NHS to pay 25% more for new drugs. How should we approach this?
Well, I think what's happened over many years is that in terms of being able to access innovative medicines, the UK has got itself to be a bit of an outlier in the sense that it has used its negotiating power, but it's used it to a point that the industry is reckons us to be in a completely inappropriate commercial position for them to sell drugs into. And in fact, the recent decisions by many of the major pharmaceutical companies to say we're not doing stuff in the UK anymore because the commercial environment is so bad. And we are a major outlier in global terms, in terms of how much we pay for drugs and also how quickly they get adopted in populations. So hopefully this will help to correct that problem, because I think it's very important to realize that the NHS, who's got a whole set of issues about efficiencies, has had a massive expansion in funding since 2017. They've gone from 160 billion to over 200 billion a year. That's a 25% increase. And they've spent most of that on employing people. So the expansion in terms of headcount has gone dramatically ahead without bringing with those people the kind of things that improve efficiency. So, and that's the capital spend on operating theaters, hospitals, drugs, IT. So there's a big disconnect, and that's why productivity has fallen.
So you're saying, relatively speaking, when you look at figures like that, £3 billion is quite small, but inevitably there'll always be, and it speaks to Leila Moran's point, people who will say any extra financial burden on the NHS, which we see being stretched and struggling every day, is a difficult thing to agree to.
It is, but this gets back to the point I've just made. Mm. It's the efficiency of the healthcare system, which relies on not just people, it relies on drugs, it relies on hospitals, capital expenditure, as well as people. And in fact, that correction, if that was to be corrected, there would be plenty of money to spend on drugs. It's a bit like having an army, giving them all rifles, but not giving them any bullets for the rifles. If you don't provide the additional tools, the health service will by definition be inefficient, which is, I'm sorry to say, where we are at the moment.
So do you think that when this is being looked at and has been looked at by successive governments over the years, and obviously the Donald Trump effect in the US is you know, specifically about this particular issue, but do you think governments are looking in the wrong direction when they're trying to model the NHS? Everything you've said there about efficiency, do you think that's what they're aiming for, or do you think their eye is off that ball?
Well, look, I think the leadership in the NHS are well aware of all the things I've said, so they are trying to shift it. It is a super tanker, and it will take some time to get it shifted around. But productivity is actually falling in the NHS at quite a dramatic rate, and we've had this massive expansion in funding and personnel. So I think getting that corrected will require bringing some of the other things into play. If you look at the state of the capital expenditure for hospitals and IT in the NHS, it's not in the right place, and similarly with drugs. So I think it's all part of the whole efficiency productivity issue, and we will not have a productive health system where people get the optimal care unless they correct those things.
And to those who look at this and see it as an opportunity to access new drugs or drugs which were previously considered too expensive, Is that the way that we should be looking at this?
Yeah, so that I think is definitely going to happen. But I also think there's something worrying going on in the background here, and that is that as new innovative medicines come in, without the headroom for the NHS to buy them, which they haven't had because they've constrained the amount of money they spent on drugs, they have become less available than they are in other countries. And let me just give you the example of the obesity medicines. There are lots of people on obesity medicines. They're almost all being bought in the private markets. And what that means that people from relatively deprived backgrounds or low socioeconomic classes are not getting access to medicines that actually have an enormous overall health benefit and prevent a whole range of different diseases. And just to remember, the reason the NHS was set up was to avoid those inequalities of health. And the failure to be able to bring those sort of medicines into the NHS is increasing the inequalities of health. So that, in my view, is a real disaster. So that is why this will help a lot, I think.
Professor John Bell, thank you for your insight. Really appreciate it. Was Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford University and has, as we were saying, advised the government over the years on life sciences.
It's now time to hear a word from my esteemed colleague here about one of the BBC's most enduring radio programmes.
From our own correspondent at 70.
All that evening, Baghdad had been shaking.
I remember recognising Chairman Mao's brilliant...
In charge of this Aladdin's cave is a babushka.
I'm Anna Foster, and to celebrate 7 decades of global reporting, I'll be talking to some familiar foreign correspondents.
And the soldier says, no, 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 no press. And Jeremy says, BBC. And the soldier looks at him and goes, Lise Doucette?
Including Lise Doucette, Jeremy Bowen, Steve Rosenberg, and Kate Adie.
Wow, what a fook I could write.
From our own correspondent at 70 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Saturday night at 8.
Sounds excellent. Highly recommend that. Definitely give that a listen. It's 8:02 now. Simon King's back with the weather.
Yeah, thank you, Anna. It's going to be a much drier day compared to yesterday across most parts of the UK, but we still have a bit of rain around this morning, and there'll be a few showers in the forecast as well. It's in Wales and southwest England where just a couple of showers this morning, some sunny spells, but I think we will see the cloud generally increasing as we head into lunchtime and this afternoon, and there'll be further showers moving their way in from the southwest. Some of those could be on the heavy side. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 7 to 9 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeastern areas of England, still a bit of rain just clearing away from the southeast of England at the moment. Otherwise, though, dry with sunshine for many this morning. We will see a bit more cloud into the South Midlands, southeast England with a few showers later on this afternoon, and top temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, it's a mostly dry start to the day. A couple of showers in the far northwest of England clearing. And then we'll see some sunshine, I think, for much of the afternoon. Dry for most of us as well, with highs of 7 to 9 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland today, variable cloud, a chance of an odd shower or two. But I think for most, actually, it should probably stay dry with highs of 7 or 8 degrees. Now, for Scotland, rain in the northeast is clearing away. Sunny spells and particularly in eastern and southern Scotland. I think it's in western Scotland that will turn more showery. The risk of some thunderstorms here as well, with highs of 5 to 9 degrees. Tonight, it's going to stay rather showery, and especially across Wales, then is northern England. Some clear spells, turning quite chilly. Temperatures by Wednesday morning, 2 to 4 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday the 2nd of December. The headlines this morning: Russia's Vladimir Putin is meeting President Trump's special envoy in Moscow later after the White House said it was very hopeful of a deal to end the Ukraine war. NHS bosses have condemned as totally reckless a planned 5-day strike by resident doctors in England just before Christmas. We'll speak to the union after the news. And the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, will today set out detailed plans to limit jury trials in England and Wales to cut delays in the courts. We'll be hearing from him in a few minutes' time.
And also coming up in the next hour, as Steve Witkoff prepares to meet Vladimir Putin, we take a deeper look at Donald Trump's property developer friend, the man he trusts to end wars.
He certainly believes he can disarm people. And that's true of President Donald Trump, too. I mean, they both believe that through sort of force of personality and sheer charisma, they can get to a deal that others can't.
And?
No snake has set foot in Zootopia in forever.
There's a snake!
Zootropolis 2, Wicked for Good, Lilo and Stitch, you can take your pick. Family films are top of the box office at the moment. So we'll ask the boss of View Cinemas, are our kids driving a return to the big screen? Before that, the BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
NHS bosses say it will be a huge challenge to keep patients safe in the lead-up to Christmas after resident doctors in England announced a five-day strike at what's been described as the most dangerous time of year for hospitals. Members of the British Medical Association will walk out from the 17th until the 22nd of December in their long-running dispute about pay and jobs. The union says it's been left with no choice because it hasn't received a credible offer from the government. But the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, accused it of turning doctors into the Grinch who stole Christmas. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The head of NHS England, Sir Jim Mackey, said that as flu cases were surging, hospitals were entering the most dangerous time of the year. He said the NHS had done everything in the last two rounds of action to minimise disruption, but it would take a monumental effort to keep patients safe this time. The decision to strike, he added, was shameful. NHS providers representing trusts argued that it was inflammatory and that the workload would be even more challenging with the task of discharging as many patients as possible ahead of Christmas. Dr. Chris Strether is Regional Medical Director for the NHS in London.
It's a really busy time. At the moment, there's a real peak in flu. The peak in influenza has come earlier than most years this year. And we had a day last week where London Ambulance had as many calls as they normally have on New Year's Eve, which is the busiest night of the year. So it's really bad timing. We'd like the BMA to reflect on that.
The government argues that resident doctors' pay has gone up nearly 29% over 3 years, but the BMA says that still doesn't fully compensate for inflation over the last decade and a half, and the strike can be avoided if there's a multi-year pay deal and further action to ensure job security for doctors.
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, will hold talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow today after the White House said it was very optimistic about reaching a deal to end the Ukraine war. The Ukrainian government has welcomed recent changes to the US proposals, but Moscow is insisting on its demands for Ukrainian territory in the east. From Moscow, here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
This will be Steve Witkoff's sixth visit to Russia this year. He'll be accompanied by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Their trip comes at a time of intense diplomatic activity. 2 weeks ago, the Americans presented to Kiev a 28-point peace plan, widely seen as heavily weighted in Moscow's favour. One of its provisions would oblige Ukraine to cede parts of the Donbass it still controls. Since then, there have been US-Ukrainian talks in Geneva and in Florida. Now an amended plan will be put to the Kremlin. President Putin has said the original draft proposal could form the basis for future agreements, but he has shown little desire for compromise, believing that Russia is winning on the battlefield and can dictate the terms of any agreement.
The talks in Moscow are taking place hours after Russian officials claim to have captured two frontline Ukrainian cities. Those claims are disputed by Ukraine. President Zelensky, who's visiting Ireland today, has said territory is still the most difficult issue in the peace negotiations. From Kyiv, our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
Russia's defence ministry has released a video of Vladimir Putin in military fatigues, apparently being briefed by his officers at a command post in the occupied Donetsk region of Ukraine. It is there where he's told about the captures of Vovchansk in the Kharkiv region and Pokrovsk in the east, where there is footage of Russian soldiers running through the mist towards the town's central square before they raise a Russian flag. A familiar optic from the grinding advances of invading troops. The Kremlin says it's also renaming Pokrovsk to Krasnoarmeysk, its old Soviet title, which means Red Army. Despite Ukrainian denials and the continued peace efforts, for Kyiv, the alleged capturing of these towns is a worrying symptom of Moscow's appetite to keep fighting rather than compromise.
The Bank of England says risks to Britain's financial system have risen this year. Its half-yearly financial stability report cited stretched valuations of companies investing in artificial intelligence, risky lending to big companies, and some trading in government bonds. The Justice Secretary David Lammy will today set out plans to curtail the ancient right to a jury trial in England and Wales to try to clear a backlog of court cases and repair what he called a justice system on the brink of collapse. Last week, the BBC saw proposals which would end jury trials for all but the most serious cases. It's not clear if that plan has been approved by the Cabinet or if changes have been made. More details from our home and legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
There are almost 80,000 cases backlogged in Crown Courts,
meaning many victims reporting crimes today won't see a suspect put on trial until 2029 or even 2030. Last week's leaked document said that David Lammy wanted cabinet colleagues to approve a plan to end jury trials for defendants facing up to 5 years in jail that would cover Crown Court cases including theft, fraud and most violent sexual or drug offences. The document also proposed allowing volunteer magistrates to jail convicted criminals for up to 2 years, doubling their current powers. That package goes further than measures recommended to the government earlier this year by a senior retired judge. The government won't confirm the final plan ahead of the announcement, but has confirmed more than £500 million for victims' services over the next 3 years.
David Lammy has told the BBC that 12 prisoners have been accidentally freed since he announced a crackdown on mistaken releases 3 weeks ago. The Justice Secretary said two were still at large. The Prime Minister has acknowledged that China poses real national security threats to the UK, but said not engaging with the country was a dereliction of duty. Speaking last night in the City of London, Sir Keir Starmer said that by taking tough steps, Britain could cooperate with China to deliver economic growth and security.
It's time for a serious approach, to reject the simplistic binary choice, neither Golden Age nor Ice Age, and recognise the plain fact that you can work and trade with a country while still protecting yourself.
In response, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Dame Priti Patel, said Sir Keir had become Beijing's useful idiot and his naive approach was putting Britain at risk. Officials in Indonesia say more than 1 million people have been displaced by catastrophic flooding on the island of Sumatra. More than 600 deaths have been reported, but that figure is expected to rise as hundreds more remain missing. The Independent Office for Police Conduct will publish its long-awaited report into the Hillsborough disaster this afternoon. The watchdog has spent more than 13 years examining the actions of South Yorkshire Police and other forces after the 1989 stadium crush in which 97 Liverpool football fans died. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
The police watchdog began its work researching Hillsborough in 2012, when it was still known as the Independent Police Complaints Commission. At the time, investigators estimated that the process would take at most 5 years. At its height, around 200 staff worked on the investigation, and the whole exercise has cost more than £80 million. It's already known that fewer than a third of the complaints and conduct matters which were under investigation have been upheld. This afternoon, more detail will be given when the IOPC's report's published, but it will only be a 400-page summary document, not the watchdog's entire findings. Some bereaved families have said they feel let down because all the police officers who were investigated have either retired or died since the 1989 disaster, and no sanctions can result from the process.
A new treatment for bowel cancer that uses low-energy X-rays instead of invasive surgery has been approved for use by the NHS. Doctors in Merseyside, who pioneered the treatment, say it could help thousands of patients avoid lifelong side effects. Our health reporter Jim Reid has more details.
The treatment, known as Papillon, is currently being used in a handful of NHS hospitals, but can now be rolled out more widely across the UK. It uses low-dose X-rays to deliver radiotherapy internally through a tube inserted into the body. That means more patients with early-stage rectal cancer should be able to avoid surgery and the potential need for a stoma bag to be worn outside the body to collect waste. 14,000 new cases of the cancer are diagnosed each year. Doctors from the Clatterbridge Cancer Centre in Liverpool say the new treatment should substantially improve the quality of life for patients and help reduce costs to the NHS.
That report from Jim Reid.
Thank you, Tom. It is now 8:10. The man in charge of the NHS in England is angry. The target of Sir Jim Mackey's ire is the doctors' union, the BMA. It's just announced another 5 days of strikes in the lead up to Christmas. And Sir Jim has condemned what he calls this totally reckless behaviour, clearly designed to maximise disruption of patient care and coming as flu cases are surging and we're entering the most dangerous time of the year for hospitals. Spelling out some of why he's so angry, earlier on the programme was Dr. Chris Strether, Regional Medical Director for the NHS in London, who said the decision is eroding the goodwill towards resident doctors.
I think they're behaving, you know, certainly totally irresponsible is a word I use, and it's harming patients. It's eroding the goodwill towards resident doctors that comes from other staff, from consultant staff, from nursing staff and other clinical staff, but also from the public. And it's in the long term, it's not going to help the high regard with which the profession's held by the public. So it's highly irresponsible.
Highly irresponsible. Well, let's hear the answer to that from the man who chairs the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, chair of the BMA Council, Dr. Tom Dolphin, who is a former chair of the Junior Doctors Committee and a consultant anaesthetist. Good morning to you, Dr. Dolphin.
Good morning.
Irresponsible, reckless, designed to maximise disruption at the most dangerous time of the year. What do you say to that?
I think what's irresponsible is failing to grasp the scale of the problem that we have when it comes to resident doctors and the medical workforce generally. We know that we need more doctors in the NHS. We know that we need specialists and GPs, but we've got thousands of resident doctors who can't get training posts this year, who are facing not being able to progress in their careers. And we know that we need them to be able to train so that they can be specialists and consultants in the future.
So training posts is what this is about rather than pay.
Well, there's two elements to it. Posts, training posts is part of it, and pay is part of it as well. They're both part of that. They're both about making sure that we have the doctors that we need in the future so that they are trained, as I say, to the standard that we need them to be specialists and GPs, and also so that they want to stay here so that they can be retained because they're valued properly in this country. If they can't get those things in the UK, then we know that they're going to go overseas to get that, to get the training, or to other countries where they're going to be valued much more highly than they are here in the UK.
Now, what Dr. Strether of the NHS in London told us earlier, what ministers also say, is they recognise that there is a problem, that there are more applicants for training places than training places. There is an offer of 1,000 extra training places. And what Dr. Strether told us is if you didn't waste the management's time having to cope with strikes, they could sit down with you to work out a better solution to this. Why don't you take up that offer?
There is nothing stopping the government from getting around the table with the BMA. We've been trying to get them to do that for some time. They've obviously had a couple of weeks since the last strikes when they could have made another offer, and they haven't come to us with one. So they've now got another 2 weeks until these strikes to try and avert these strikes by coming up
with an offer. What is your proposal when it comes to training places? What is your proposal?
Well, when we're talking about the 1,000 posts, the 2,000 posts that the government is talking about, isn't going to touch the size. We've got 30,000 people applying for 10,000 jobs. So 2,000 isn't going to cut it.
What we need
is a change to the system. I'm trying to get to that. What we need is a change to the system so that we can have a prioritisation of those already in the system, UK graduates, those working in the UK, so that they can be retained in the UK. They can train up, remain within our system and not be displaced by people coming from overseas, which is part of the current problem.
And pay. You continue to insist that you deserve above inflation pay rises. You had 22% in the years 23 and 4. You had more than 5% this year, 5.4%. That is more than any other public sector worker. Why do you think you, and uniquely you, should get even bigger pay rises at a time when NHS budgets are stretched?
I wouldn't say it's uniquely us. There are lots of public sector workers who need to have their pay restored, but doctors happen to be at the very bottom of that pile in terms of pay loss over the time period since 2008.
Well, only as I put to you in previous interviews, if you choose certain figures designed to make it look bad, if, as the Nuffield Trust points out, you choose not to measure your pay loss from 2008, as you always do, but measure it instead from 2015, from a much more recent baseline, you've had an increase in pay, not a cut in pay.
Well, the government seems to think we deserve more cuts in pay because they propose that we should have another real terms pay cut next year. They're suggesting that we need to have at least 1% less than what inflation currently is. So the government clearly thinks we're overpaid at the moment and wants to give us less. Doctors aren't going to stand for that. We know our value. We know the value that we had in previous years, and we want to be paid that value. No more. We're not asking for extra pay. We're asking for the pay
to have
the value.
Yes, you are. You're asking for a huge pay rise. Now, I put it to you again. You ignored the question. Your pay has gone up by 7.9% since 2015. By the government's calculation, it's gone up by 28.9% in recent years. So far from having a pay cut, you've had significant pay increases, not as big as you'd like, I've no doubt, but they are increases.
They are, but they're on the background of losses before that. If you disregard the time before 2015, if you ignore the time from 2008 to 2015, then yeah, you can demonstrate there's been an increase, but that ignores the fact those big losses in that time period.
And so you've just conceded your pay has increased each year since 2015. Significant increase above inflation since 2015. 7.9%.
What I'm telling you is that since 2008...
No, I didn't ask you that. Has your pay gone up by almost 8% since 2015?
That's not relevant. We're talking about what our pay used to be worth.
It may not be relevant, but it is my question, and I think listeners would like to know the answer to it. Has doctors' pay, junior doctors' pay, gone up by almost 8% in real terms above CPI measure of inflation since 2015? Yes or no?
The exact figures I don't have since 2015 because I haven't got the graph in front of me to look at to plot that out. There has been some
7.9 sounds about right to you, does it? If the Nuffield Trust Foundation, which is a respected independent health tank, doesn't seem to me you're disputing that.
I didn't catch which measure of inflation you said you were going to use either.
CPI.
You were talking about
CPI.
CPI. Yeah, so we, as you know, prefer RPI because we think that you've got to include housing costs in the measure. So there's a big drop, a bigger drop when you look, take into account housing as well, which CPI doesn't take into account. And of course, our members
live
in houses.
I'm sure we'd all prefer a measure that gives us a bigger pay rise, but an independent think tank using the figures that are used by the Bank of England and Her Majesty's Treasury say you've had a whopping pay rise since 2015. And you're not disputing that, are you? Dr. Golphin.
If that's the calculation they've done for CPI, that's the calculation they've done. I'm not going to sit here and try and recalculate that live in front of you because I don't have the graph in front of me.
It's not a question of recalculating. It is a fact.
Sure. I'm not arguing with you on that, Nick. What I'm telling you is that the date that you're picking is not the date that we recognise because we're talking about a loss in value because we're still doing no less work. In fact, the patients are sicker than they were in 2008, and we think we should be valued the same as that.
So
I don't see why interim figures are particularly relevant because we're talking about the loss over that time period. There's been some regain of that, some restoration of that pay, but overall, we are still way down. And trying to pick a figure in the interim to try and make that look invalid just doesn't work for us.
Well, look, there may be plenty of listeners who are sympathetic to the plight of junior doctors and know of junior doctors who are indeed moving abroad, as you suggest, but they would still, I think, argue, many of them, that to strike just before Christmas at a time of massive winter pressures, at a time when people want to spend Christmas with their loved ones, is a pretty brutal decision, isn't it?
Well, talking about Christmas doesn't really make much sense. The strikes end before Christmas. And in any case, people who are in hospital are covered by senior doctors because they come under the heading of urgent and emergency care, of course. So like any strike period over the last couple of years, they will be looked after by senior doctors. If they're well enough to go home for Christmas, they can be discharged. That's not a problem.
Well, the other day you suggested that spending Christmas with loved one was, and I quote, sentimental. Is that your view of people wanting to get out of hospital to spend time at home at Christmas if they can? Sentimental.
Well, I'm going to be in the hospital on Christmas Day myself working, and it seems to me talking about Christmas is a cynical ploy by the employer's side to make an emotional argument.
Is it sentimental? Oh, it's emotional. Is it emotional and sentimental for people running the NHS, want people to be home at Christmas?
Not at all. People want to be home at Christmas, and the strikes doesn't prevent that. That's what I'm saying.
It's not what you did say. You said it was sentimental, and I'm asking you why you said it.
People wanting to be at home at Christmas is an emotional thing. Like, people are human beings. People have emotions and they want to be at home over Christmas. That's perfectly reasonable. That's, you know, we are human beings. We want to spend time with our families. The doctors and nurses who will be in hospital on Christmas Day, like myself, do recognize that people want to be at home. They themselves would prefer to be at home, but they know where they need to be. So that in itself is an argument that the government is making to distract people from the fact that you've got a long-term workforce problem that needs solving. You've got thousands of doctors without posts to come to. You've got patients who need those doctors to be training so that they can get the waiting lists down, and that's not what's happening. So they're making arguments about Christmas to distract from the long-term workforce problem that is the essence of the problem here.
Arguably, having to cope with repeated strikes, and they have gone on for years now, means that they are distracted from making the changes that you want to make. Isn't the truth of this, Dr. Dolphin? You're a highly political man. You were an agent for Dawn Butler, the left-wing Labour MP, in three general elections. You tried to become a candidate for the Labour Party at the last election, and you complained that they didn't even shortlist you. You are using junior doctors, some might think, to pursue a political cause.
I mean, if I wanted to become a Labour MP, doing what I'm currently doing to the Labour government doesn't seem a very good way of going about it, does it?
Maybe they had a sense of that because you'd been on strike repeatedly beforehand, before they decided not to shortlist you for one of the seats.
My political career isn't really the relevant thing here. I'm here representing a trade union, okay? Trade unions are a force for good in society. They're about workers coming together to demand fair treatment. They're why we've got paid sick leave and paid maternity leave. They're why we've got safety regulations at work. They're why we've even got the weekend. And I'm here representing a trade union. That's the purpose of me being here. We've got resident doctors coming together to demand fair treatment, to demand the opportunity to be able to train in the UK and to become specialists, become GPs, and they're not currently being given that. Doctor. They have repeatedly asked the government for that. They're not being given that opportunity. That's why we're back on strike again.
Dr. Tom Dolphin, Chair of the BMA Council, thank you for taking the time.
It's 21 minutes past eight. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is before Parliament later and will set out plans to try to reduce the unprecedented backlog of court cases waiting to be heard in England and Wales. Part of that is expected to be the scaling back of jury trials for various offences, which has received a mixed response. There are currently 80,000 or so Crown Court cases that are awaiting trial. Some trial dates are now being set for as far away as 2029 and 2030. And over the next 5 years, that number is expected to rise to more than 100,000 without some type of action. Well, David Lammy, the Justice Secretary, Deputy Prime Minister, joins us on the programme. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I know that you are setting out the detail later today, so we're going to be talking more about the principle, because yes. You can't tell us what you're going to be unveiling later. But the right to jury trial, or what we call either way offences, are at the centre of this. It's probably worth explaining to people. You have summary offences that go to the magistrates' court. You have indictable offences that go to the Crown Court. And in the middle, you have these either way offences where people, defendants, can choose. So would removing that right really help cut the backlog?
Well, it's important to centre the victims, as you've done, to recognise that if you're a woman who's raped today in London, your case might not be heard till 2028. Juries remain fundamental in our system, and I will absolutely be reaffirming that in Parliament this afternoon. As you know, Anna, 90% of cases in our country are dealt with by magistrates who can sentence for up to a year. That then leaves 10% of cases that go to our Crown Courts. 7% of people effectively plead guilty and go straight to sentencing by a judge. That then leaves 3% of cases that have jury trials in our system. And when we asked Brian Leveson to look at this issue, yes, he wanted to see more investment in courts and more sitting days. We are doing that. Yes, he wanted to see modernisation. We are doing that. But he also suggested reform. And in looking at these group of cases that we describe as triable either way, that's where someone can elect to have a jury. The question before me and before us is, if you steal a bike, if you're in possession of a Class C drug like cannabis, if you've got a dangerous dog, for cases like that, should you be able to elect to go before a jury, or should that be dealt with by a magistrate or by a judge? And that's the decision I've got. And really, we're talking about sentences up to around 3 years. That was the level that Sir Brian asked us to consider.
Yeah, I think one of the key questions, though, is how much time will this save? Because Sir Brian Leveson said it was highly uncertain. He put a measure on it of 20%. But if you look at it, there will still need to be presentation of evidence. There'll still need to be a case for the prosecution, a case for the defence. Realistically, how much time would be saved by not having a jury?
Well, two things that I'm weighing. One is that we have not got significant backlogs in our magistrates' courts, and I am recruiting more magistrates over this next period. So, yes, at the moment they can sentence up to a year. Brian has effectively asked us to look at whether they could sentence beyond that.
Oh, is that something you're considering?
And that would take off, obviously, some of that number. And then he's made recommendations about a new division within the Crown Court for these tribal either way. His estimate is 20%. He's also crystal clear that we will have to throw everything at this subject, that includes investment, it includes sitting days. Today, I'm also making announcements about barristers' fees, which have to rise, and I'm allocating more money for that, so that criminal legal aid lawyers want to be in that area of law, and that we've got the pipeline of young people who want to be criminal legal aid lawyers. And again, I'm announcing a match-funded scheme in relation to that, all to increase capacity, also that we can see that backlog reducing and coming down by the next general election.
To stay on that topic of juries a little bit longer, and you have talked yourself in the past about the importance of juries, but you're also quoted in the papers saying today that delayed justice is no justice. So your opinion on that has clearly shifted a little. What about something like mode of trial, for example, which is where the magistrate or the district judge gets to decide where the case is heard? Will that still exist? Or are you taking that away as well as the defendant's right to choose?
Well, two things there in your question. One, the Magna Carta, Article 39, is really what establishes that idea of being judged by your peers, fundamental in our system. Two, Article 40 also established that justice delayed is justice denied. And here we're seeing a lot of delay. And it means, for example, that 60% of rape victims are dropping out. They're dropping out because they don't want to be re-traumatized over 3 or 4 years, witnesses falling away. And that we've got to address.
Yeah. Well,
in terms
of
mode of trial, in terms of mode of trial, that decision, whether you should be able as the defendant to choose whether you have a jury or indeed you are dealt with by a magistrate, other common law jurisdictions do not give the defendant that choice. And of course, that is something I'm reflecting on.
But what about the magistrate relates, or the district judge?
Particularly when it relates to a crime like a driving licence flawed, fly tipping, theft of a bike. Should you be able to elect in those sorts of cases to be heard by a jury? If it is heard by a jury, that could be a 2-day trial.
But
inevitably,
about,
that will delay.
But you're talking about the defendant's
case, the murder
choice,
case, the manslaughter case.
And that comes after mode of trial. So is that something that you're going to take away from the magistrate or the district judge?
I will make my announcement later on this afternoon. But is there more that our judiciary could do in determining that is certainly a central question that Brian raises.
It wouldn't be a popular decision among magistrates and district judges, would it, to take that choice away from them?
Well, I've spoken to a number of judges over the course of this process in trying to reach that determination and get that balance right so that the system, the integrity, both of the jury system and indeed of our criminal justice system is upheld, and we have a system that is safe and secure and appropriate for victims of crime. And that's central to my dilemma and what we're seeking to fix.
I also wanted to ask you about a conversation you had a little earlier with our colleagues on BBC Breakfast when you were talking about the accidental release of prisoners. And you said that 12 prisoners had been accidentally released since you made your statement to Parliament on the 11th of November. Now, there'd been 91 releases in error in the period between April and November. You described it as being on a downward trajectory, but the figures don't necessarily bear that out. If you average them out over that period, it looks like the trajectory is exactly the same. And it's something that you're supposed to be concentrating on. So are those numbers going down?
Well, I'm looking at the trend over the course of this year. I've asked Dame Lynn Owens to do an independent review. And obviously, we will get her recommendations in the spring and we will act on that. But in the meantime, I've sent in a digital squad. I've had a performance board across the system.
Sorry, just on that point, is it a downward trajectory? Well, because you said it was, but again, the numbers don't bear that out.
What I meant by that is the trend this year does seem at this stage to be going in the right direction. But
Based on what? Can I finish my point? I'm just trying to work these numbers out because they're not making sense.
Anna, can I finish my point? The trend is on a downward trajectory based on last year's figures. But I did say in Parliament there has been a spike. This is a paper-based system. We lost 6,000 officers in the last government. We've got very junior officers doing a very good, very tough job. 57,000 prisoners are released from prison every year. The spike is too high. I want to bring it down, but we have got a mountain to climb.
Yeah, but can I just get clarity on that point about that, because it's important. You said there was a downward trajectory, but the numbers don't suggest that. And then you talked about a trend from last year. Are you correct when you say that there is a downward trajectory this year, since April, and certainly since the 11th of November, about prisoners not being released accidentally?
Anna, I'm talking about the checks that I've put in place since the Kabatu release recently. And it looks to me, from what I'm seeing, that there is a downward trend. But I've
but you can't say that 100%.
Anna, please
though.
Let me finish the point.
But you're not answering my question, Mr.
I am answering
Lamy.
The question. If you let me finish the point, please do. But I've also said that there is caution around this because it's a paper-based system. We have junior officers doing this work. I am still waiting for Dame Lynn Owens to report and to act on her recommendations. And there are still errors happening in the system. I cannot rule out human error in a paper-based system where we have 57,000 releases. There have always been releases in error over my lifetime and your lifetime. But this spike is unacceptable. It began under the last government. I am attempting to bear down on it. It will take time and investment right across our prison system.
OK, but the downward trajectory will take a bit more looking at. David Lemmy, the Deputy Prime Minister, Justice Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Cathy's here with the sports news now at 28 minutes to nine.
Thank you. We'll start with some breaking cricket news from this morning. England men have made one change for the second Ashes test against Australia and Brisbane. All-rounder Will Jacks comes in replacing the injured Mark Wood for the day-night test, which starts this Thursday. The Tottenham manager, Thomas Frank, says he is very confident he has the backing of the club's owners, despite Spurs only winning one Premier League game at home this season. They are in 12th place in the table and they face 13th place Newcastle United tonight. England women play the last game of their season, a friendly against Ghana in what has been a successful year after the Lionesses retained their European Championship title. Scotland host China and Wales women face Switzerland at 11 this morning. Now, the Emirates GBR team has become the first team in Sail GP history to do the treble, that's winning the season grand final, the Impact League, and also topping the season standings on points. And we can speak to the double Olympic sailing champion, Hannah Mills, part of that Emirates GBR team. Morning, Hannah. Congratulations.
Hello,
I'm very well, thank you. Congratulations. The first British team as well to win the SailGP title. It was a difficult weekend, though. How much pressure did all of you feel knowing that there's a winner-takes-all race at the end of that weekend?
Yeah, tons of pressure. It's definitely akin to the Olympics, for sure, in that respect of just how much it means, you know, how much you want to do it for the team. And yeah, just the prestige of winning SailGP League.
Yeah, well, it's a big factor that you've done it for the first time as a British team, but also that triple element of winning all three trophies. And we came to the SailGP Technologies factory to see sort of how the F50s are built. And you had just learned that your team had won the Impact League, which you were pretty emotional about at the time. How were the celebrations after winning the grand final as well?
Yeah, the celebrations were good. I'm not going to lie. We definitely let our hair down. But yeah, you know, winning the Impact League, which is kind of the only trophy in sport around sustainability and having impact socially as well, as a team was massive. So yeah, we were pretty emotional about that, just how much work goes into that on our projects. But then to top it off by obviously winning on the water, which is what we're there to do, was, yeah, honestly, just unbelievable as a team. Just very proud of everyone.
Yeah, I'm sure Sir Ben Ainslie was leading those celebrations, knowing him, but he has taken a back seat sort of when it comes to driving the boat. He's CEO of Emirates now, but he didn't drive the boat this year. Dylan Fletcher did that, who's also an Olympic champion. How much of you topping the season standings on points is down to Dylan and that consistency?
Yeah, I mean, Dylan's done the most amazing job jumping in. Obviously, filling Ben's shoes is a pretty hard thing to do for anyone. And Dylan's taken it on so well. And for us, like, we've grown up sailing together for a long, long time, done two Olympics together. So for us, our kind of chemistry, I guess, on board of how we talk about the racing and just the communication between us just clicked instantly. So yeah, Dill's done a phenomenal job. You know, we are racing in boats that are all absolutely equal. You know, the boats are exactly the same. It's just down to the skill of the sailors. And yeah, for Dill to step in and do that was pretty amazing.
And you're an important part of that as the strategist, but also we discussed the possibility of having light winds in Abu Dhabi, which would mean that you then combine your role as the strategist with being one of the grinders. And you're the only woman on the F50. How did that go this weekend?
Yeah, as expected, actually, in Abu Dhabi, we had quite light winds. So I was at the front of the boat. Usually I'm at the back of the boat doing strategy, just behind Dylan, the driver. But I was at the front of the boat doing the grinding role as well, which is like a super physical role. It's basically cycling with your arms to pull the big wing sail in. So I'm not necessarily the right stature for that. But it's one of just the things about Sail GP. When it's light winds, you lose crew numbers to keep the weight off the boat to try and get them up and foiling and going fast quicker. So yeah, doing the grinding and communicating the strategy. Definitely at times my tempo was a bit high just because you're at max heart rate trying to communicate. But yeah, it was good. You know, we're really comfortable as a team in that configuration with just four people on board rather than the six. And yeah, we managed to smash it on the Sunday and get the win.
Well, congratulations again on winning the Sail GP title. Hannah Mills, thank you for joining me. Just a quick tennis slide. Jack Draper has delayed his comeback from an arm injury. The British tennis number one and world number 10 has pulled out of this week's Ultimate Tennis Showdown event, which was in London.
And he's still amazingly high in the rankings, despite not playing.
I mean, world number 10 when you've only played half of the year, effectively, is incredible.
Really extraordinary. Carthy, we look forward to him coming back. Now, what else can we look forward to? We can look forward to, at 9 this morning, the second of this year's Wreath Lectures.
Most of us want to be seen and admired.
The 2025 Wreath Lectures continue.
But in our society, today, we admire the wrong things and the wrong people.
The historian Rutger Bregman delivers the second of his lectures on moral revolution.
What the British abolitionist taught me is that it is possible to rewrite a nation's honour code.
Considering how small groups of committed people can change the world for the better.
Our goal should be to make future historians proud. The 2025 Wreath Lectures
on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds continues this morning at 9.
The weather today will be breezy. There'll be some variable cloud around and some showers as well, but it should be a bit drier and brighter to the east.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at 23 minutes. Sorry, just learning to count here, Tom. Minutes to nine. Tom Sanders has got a summary of the news for us.
NHS bosses have described a planned five-day strike by resident doctors in the build-up to Christmas as totally reckless. Tom Dolphin from the Doctors' Union, the BMA, told us there was nothing stopping the government negotiating and coming up with an offer on jobs and pay. He said talking about Christmas was a cynical ploy by the employers' side. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has told this programme juries remain fundamental as he prepares to set out plans to limit jury trials in England and Wales to clear the backlog of court cases. A document seen by BBC News last week suggested they would only be used for the most serious offences. Mr. Lammy revealed that 12 prisoners had been accidentally freed since he announced a crackdown on mistaken releases 3 weeks ago, and two were still at large. He said there had been an unacceptable spike in such cases, but the trends now seem to be going in the right direction. President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is to meet President Putin in Moscow to present him with an amended plan to end the war in Ukraine. Earlier, Russia claimed its forces had fully captured the Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk.
Thank you very much indeed. It is coming up now to 21 minutes to 9 o'clock. Let us turn to those talks between Russia and the United States. Steve Witkoff is the US special envoy to the Middle East and Donald Trump's trusted negotiator with Vladimir Putin on ending the war in Ukraine. And he is, as we were just hearing, going to meet Putin today. But in the 90s, he was a rising real estate player in New York, carrying a licensed handgun on his ankle and learning the art of the deal make. Of the deal from Trump himself. So which of those hard-earned skills might translate to the high-stakes diplomacy he's now involved in? To help answer that, I've been speaking to David Kirkpatrick, staff writer at the New York Magazine and the first person to profile Steve Witkoff in 1998 when he was working for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him what his talent was in his early days.
His thing was leverage. He was about buying up giant office towers, prestigious, famous, landmark office towers, using an enormous amount of debt. So he was very good at persuading bankers to lend him money, and that would allow him to outbid everybody else.
And he was selling them often to the same sorts of people as he's now negotiating with, foreign leaders.
Well, not always, but it's true that is, you know, he sold to various entities, but it's a unusual characteristic of our current political moment that Donald Trump and his right-hand man, Steve Witkoff, are both in the business of selling real estate assets. So These are people now doing business as political leaders, as leaders of states, who in the past and in the future have done business as businessmen.
And just describe the man you got to know in the 90s, because he was, it seems to me from your profile, the polar opposite of a quiet, low-key diplomat in his style.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, he was a larger-than-life personality. He certainly thought of himself as a larger-than-life personality. You know, he liked the Godfather movies. He started as a lawyer and worked a little bit for Donald Trump and thought to himself, that's who I want to be. And then he went on from there, and he was a slumlord for a while, owning buildings in the Bronx and Harlem and wearing a handgun strapped to his ankle. And he made his way up. And by the time I knew him, you know, he like the Godfather, made a habit of hiring people who worked for him in one capacity or other, or their son-in-law or their nephew or the nephew of his lender. He ran his operation like a family affair, and he would hang around and smoke cigars and drink martinis and say, how good is this at a New York steakhouse? He invited me up to a restaurant here in East Harlem called Rayo's that was once a mafia hangout and now is enormously exclusive. He had a regular table there every Tuesday night, and he brought me up, and at our table was the head of Lehman Brothers, the now defunct investment bank, which was his lender, and also a Bo Dietl, a famous former police detective who's also a colorful character.
Colorful is clearly the word. And does that mean that he can disarm people that he's dealing with?
Well, I think we're in a situation where he certainly believes he can disarm people. And that's true of his boss, President Donald Trump, too. I mean, they both believe that through sort of force of personality and sheer charisma, they can get to a deal that others can't. You know, cynics might say, well, it's paying a higher price. It's offering something that no one else is offering that enables you to get to those deals. You know, we'll have to see how that plays out.
Now, you're not a diplomatic correspondent, but when you got to see the notes of what was said to be the deal between Witkoff and Putin, did you recognize some patterns?
Yeah, I absolutely did. He sounded like the Witkoff I knew, you know, counting on his personal charisma and a personal bond to try to make things happen where they seemed impossible. It did sound like he was advising the Russians on how to manipulate his own boss, President Trump. But who knows? Maybe this is all part of some grand stratagem. He certainly believed that he could develop a kind of rapport with this Putin advisor, and the two of them could kind of push the ball forward.
Knowing what you do know, if you were Ukrainian, would you be hopeful or terrified?
You know, it's high stakes. I would say he was a gambler. He likely remains a gambler. I sent a copy of my old article about him to someone I know who was involved in the negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, which Witkoff also was involved in. And this person wrote back and said, you know, he's brought his whole personality to his new gig.
Even if he's left the handgun at home.
Even if he's left the handgun at home.
David Kirkpatrick, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, thank you.
It is just coming round to 16 minutes to nine now. When a dam collapsed at a Chinese copper mine in Zambia earlier this year, the toxic waste and heavy metals that poured into the surrounding waterways and the farmland made it the country's worst environmental disaster. Now, China is one of the biggest foreign investors in the region, and it's often framed its relationship with Africa as a win-win, an opportunity for China to access critical minerals while helping African countries to industrialise and to boost their economies. Well, our Africa correspondent Myoni Jones travelled to Zambia's copper belt in the north of the country to look at what that dam collapse tells us about Chinese influence in the region.
I'm walking to meet Frederick, a local farmer whose crops have been affected by the spill. I mean, I'm surrounded by fields. I can see him hoeing in the distance. Some of the fields are green and lush, but a lot of the nearby ones are completely burnt out. There's dried leaves underfoot. Nothing seems to be growing here.
I'm 73 years old, man. My legs are still paining, very much pain, which is very difficult to move. I used to walk with a stick.
Have you been to see a doctor about your leg?
The doctor says maybe if we are using this contaminated water, maybe it can cause this.
I'm by a stream at the bottom of Frederick's farm. It's connected to the Kafue River, which was polluted in February. And the water looks clear, serene. You'd never know a massive chemical spill had happened here earlier this year. But the tell is that you can't see any living life here. And the villagers say this stream used to be teeming with fish and now there's nothing. Frederick says he was given just £500 compensation by Sinometals, the company responsible for the spill and a subsidiary of a state-owned Chinese firm. Some commentators have suggested the spill illustrates some of the downsides of Chinese investments in Africa. We've just driven down a dirt road off of the main road, somewhere private, so we can interview a worker from Sinometals who's agreed to speak to us on the condition of anonymity. How safe do you feel working at Sinometals?
He says there's not much safety given by the company, but he's speaking for himself and not in general for other people. Maybe for other people, they have enough, but and they feel safe enough. But for him, he doesn't feel as safe.
Can you just give me an idea generally of what doesn't make you feel safe there?
So he says the PP is not 100%. They would use it and sometimes get spoiled. So they would just take a risk and use it again, like when there's another job, and they would use the same PP and not new ones would be provided.
To hear that this area where your family lives can be contaminated for decades, how does that make you feel?
He says he doesn't feel okay. He feels bad because that's where his family is.
In some ways, this man's plight illustrates that of his government. He benefits financially from Chinese investment, but it comes at a high personal cost. We reached out to Sinometals for comment. They didn't respond, but the Chinese embassy in Zambia told the BBC that Sinometals has worked hard to improve water pollution levels. It added that they've paid all fines, compensated 454 households, and kept paying their employees, despite their mining operations being suspended for more than 6 months. Critics say the Zambian government acted too slowly after the spill, blaming its estimated £3.7 billion debt to China.
Of course, we had challenges.
Dr. Duti Chibamba is from the Ministry of Green Economy and the Environment.
So whether we are in debt with China, the Chinese have to follow our rules and laws. There is no treating them with kid gloves here. We don't care whether we are owing them or that's not about this. That's not the issue. The issue is that there's some pollution that has happened. It must be cleaned up.
Professor Stephen Chan from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies says Zambia is in a good position to get the Chinese to pay more.
The Chinese don't have that much leverage over Zambia when it has a foreign policy that also speaks to the Americans. So the last thing the Chinese want is to drive the Zambians much closer into the hands of the Americans.
He says African countries in general are becoming savvier when working with foreign partners.
It's not Africa being taken for a ride, it's Africa coming of age. The way to look at it is that it's becoming a player in the world with all of the different actors in the world.
Back in the Copper Belt, school children swim in a tributary of the Kafue, Zambia's longest river. Over 100 local farmers have launched one of the biggest environmental lawsuits in Zambia's history against Sinometals. The spill here has raised questions around how much leverage African countries have against Chinese companies accused of wrongdoing. How this case goes could provide answers to these questions.
As Miney Jones reporting, it's just coming round to 10 to 9. You might remember in October, the former BBC presenter Mark Mardell was told that he could not board a Turkish Airlines flight. They said that because he has Parkinson's and didn't have a medical certificate that he wasn't allowed to board, which is something that Mark raised awareness of and talked about because it's not something that most airlines do. But it appears that that situation has changed. And he joins us. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what's your understanding of what has happened? It looks like Turkish Airlines have changed their mind.
It does look as if they have. I think we're winning, but we haven't won yet. Because what they've done is they've dropped the requirement for Parkinson's. But then they've said said they're deeply saddened that their policy has been perceived in this manner. And as a result of a misunderstanding, whereas it wasn't a misunderstanding at all. It was, I was banned from the flight. And now they've got a policy that says for all sick and disabled passengers, We can give admission to board our sick passengers have no infectious diseases, provided they submit a medical report. So I hope my campaign hasn't actually resulted with everybody with diabetes, heart condition, whatever, being banned from Turkish Airlines unless they have a medical report. But it does seem that they've changed it on one website. An eagle-eyed friend of mine spotted this. But it hasn't been changed on the UK. It's been changed on the UK site, but it hasn't been changed on the American English site or French or German or Italian. So I think there's a lot of questions still remain.
And it's worth just explaining to people as well that this is not something that you've had to do before with other airlines, and that was why you wanted to speak up about it.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I've been travelling. I've had Parkinson's for about 3 years, and I've been travelling pretty widely during that time. And I've been getting assisted boarding from all other airlines that I've travelled with. Never had a problem, and I haven't heard of anybody else having a problem. And so it's outrageous that, you know, we do feel that Parkinson's on Movers and Shakers, the podcast I take part in with others like Rory Kettleman-Jones, you know, it does have a bit of an image problem, a bit of a Cinderella disease, so people don't always think of it as in the same way as other diseases. And so why it makes it much worse to single it out like this. And I was left in a horrific way, really. I mean, I'm feeling quite chipper this morning, but I mean, I was sort of left in this airport on my own for 7 hours looking for my bags, staggering around. So they said it wasn't safe for me to fly, apparently, and it was for my own good, I was told. But yet they left me in this vast airport, nearly on the verge of tears, you know, unable to find my bag, which had been taken off the flight. So it's really important to raise it, I think, and stop it happening. And so what I want to know now is, you know, are they going to retrain their staff? Are they going to tell them there's been a change of policy, or is it just a statement they put out to a couple of people?
Well, that, as you quite rightly highlight, is the difficulty here, because there are lots of staff in lots of places, lots of airports around the world, and it's a question of, as you say, making a clear change in policy and communicating it, if that is what's happened. Otherwise, this will continue to happen to people like it happened to you.
Yeah, and it's very weird. I mean, I was searching when I realised that this change had happened. And as I say, they didn't make any effort whatsoever to communicate with me. I know that British journalists have been ringing them very regularly to find out whether there was a news statement. I was sort of searching around the web and found that they had actually told the People magazine, the American magazine, about this. And then later on the Jeremy Vine show, because they'd asked for a statement. They got a statement, but nobody else has been given it. And it just seems a bit weird, really, that, you know, if they are going to do this properly, they do need to say, tell everybody they're doing it, changing the policy. You don't have to have a medical certificate if you've got Parkinson's. And the staff is going to be retrained. And I think that's really the key to me, is are they going to tell the staff their policy has changed, and are they going to retrain them? Yeah. They certainly need it.
Well, you and we, I'm sure, will seek further clarity on it. Mark Mardell, thank you, as always, for joining us.
It's 7:07. Coming up on Woman's Hour later this morning, Nuala McGovern's going to be joined by Chef Pam, discussing why memory and emotion are so important when creating dishes, and also look at friendships with ex-partners. That's with Nuala on Woman's Hour. Let's turn, at the end of the programme, to the subject of what's on at your cinema recently. Have you taken a look? Because you might just detect a rather interesting pattern.
Let me ask you something. Do you think we're a good team?
Of course. A zoo. I just wish I knew what we had to do to prove it to everyone else.
I know I'm who I am today because I knew you.
Think of what we could do together.
I wish for a friend. Like a best friend.
Now, if you're of a certain age or kids of a certain age in your house, you will know that that was Zootopolis, Wicked, For Good, Lilo and Stitch, all PG films targeted at kids and their families. And they are increasingly seen as the key to filling cinemas that perhaps struggle sometimes to tempt us away from our big screens at home. Let's talk about that trend with a man who knows, the founder, chief executive of View International, Tim Richards, and also with Isabel Stevens, managing editor of the Sight and Sound magazine published by BFI. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Is that what's working, Tim, getting the kids into cinemas?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the good news is that not just kids' movies are back, but all movies are back. And next year will be the first year in 5 years that we haven't had production and movie supply restricted by pandemics or Hollywood strikes. And we're seeing it right now. The beginning of the end has happened. I mean, Wicked has come out of the blocks doing incredible numbers worldwide. Zootropolis, massive numbers. And what's really exciting is it did $275 million in China. So the Chinese market is back as well. But as you mentioned, the kids' movies, I mean, next year we're going to have a massive number of kids' movies ranging from Super Mario to Minions, new IP from the incredible Pixar Hoppers. So we've got a lot of movies coming out, and we're going to end this year with potentially one of the biggest of all times, the new Avatar, which had its premiere last night in Los Angeles.
Interesting. And Isabel, what's striking, though, is it is for younger children rather than teenagers that we're getting these big blockbuster films.
Yes. I mean, I think audiences have tired a little bit of superhero films, which were sort of ruling the box office. And I think younger audiences, you know, they're surrounded by screens all the time. And maybe they're seeing the value of the big screen, you know, seeing a film really big and loud. That's certainly a trend that we've seen kind of at the BFI's IMAX screen. And the, you know, the cost of bringing a family to the cinema, it's not as much as, you know, many other activities.
That's interesting, Tim. Do you think there is beginning of a trend back to cinema? Because we really did think, didn't we, during COVID, and you must have feared, that's it, right? People are watching the screens at home now.
I never did, because we even in the last 5 years, this year alone, there's been 20% fewer films released globally than pre-pandemic period. So, but what we've seen in that post-pandemic period is we've broken records for every genre of film for all demographics. So our audiences never left us. They just didn't have the movies. And the movies are back now. And, you know, we've seen even with Minecraft. And what's really exciting about movies like Minecraft and Zootropolis, that's our future. That's our future audiences. And getting them excited and having them come back and see what a great experience in an afternoon or evening out with your friends or family, what that's all about. And that's why they're going to be coming back.
Isabel, it takes us back many decades, doesn't it, the idea of the big family show?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it takes us back to films like The Wizard of Oz or It's a Wonderful Life, when Hollywood did really make films for everybody. And there is something really nice about sitting in the cinema and seeing people from all different backgrounds and ages all enjoying watching a film together. But, you know, I think there's also something about these family films that we shouldn't overlook, which is the kind of joy in them and the kind of world building that they bring. I mean, a lot of them also are centered around music. Look at, you know, Minecraft with Jack Black's Lava Chicken song, Wicked, and also a film like K-pop Demon Hunters that was really, you know, is really powered by music. And that's interesting as well, because that was a film that was watched a lot on Netflix, and then people did come out to the cinema when it was released briefly there.
Tim, is there another thing? Last time I was in one of your movie theaters, God, I call it that now, I used to call it a cinema, there we are, I was struck by the advert saying turn off the phone, enjoy the silence, trying to make it actually one of the reasons you want to be in the cinema.
It's an amazing escape, and there aren't many areas in life or times in life when you have an opportunity to really turn off and enjoy something selfishly without having to worry about an Amazon delivery coming into your home, and something you can enjoy with your family or a partner. And, you know, and I think, as you know, just mentioned, we're a very competitive form of out-of-home entertainment. And we understand and appreciate that a lot of our customers are price sensitive. And for that reason, you know, we've really made an effort to make our pricing accessible for everyone across the country.